Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Great to be back with you. And yeah, get calling, 313-298-WRIF. Couple of figures here. Let's see, $70.55. That's what crude oil is trading at in the world market. So look for $3 a gallon. ITMFA. ITMFA. Have you learned what that is yet? Well, can't really say it on the air. You can kind of figure it out by some of the initials. But go to my website, peterwerby.com. PETERWERBE.com. PETERWERBE.com. Actually, it was right at the top, but now you got to go down. I mean, every week is a roller coaster, isn't it, in terms of what's going on? Bush got caught in a couple more lies. Not even big news anymore, right? Oh, yeah, the leak. Remember that whole leak about the CIA agent? Turns out the leak came from him. Well, wasn't he going to fire the person when he discovered who it was? Yeah, ITMFA, or just quit. Just quit. Get out of there. Go home. Go back to Texas. Clear some brush. Hey, what was the other thing? Oh, yeah, this whole, I mean, it is such a rush of mis- and disinformation that we are learning that a lot of us knew all along. Some of you that are trusting people, that trust people in authority, bad mistake. Bad mistake, or that just didn't pay much attention. And so remember, I've been advising you, when any politician, particularly this gang in power now, says something, assume it's a lie. Doesn't mean you got to go out there and say, he's lying, he's lying. Yeah, he probably is, and you probably could shout it, but just make that assumption. So involve yourself in critical thinking on all of this, including what I'm saying. I'm not trying to tell you to accept what I'm saying. We're trying to look, one of the things, we're getting information, but it's also important that Americans learn to think critically. People do that in most every other country in the world. We don't do it here. No matter how many times we've been fooled by the politicians that run our lives and the heads of corporations that that control our economic destiny, and we get the rug yanked out from under us time after time after time, and we're just back there again. Yes, sir. Oh yes, I believe that. You said it. It must be true. I saw you standing up there with a little flag on your lapel of your suit, and you looked right at me, and there are all these flags behind you, and you were sitting at this desk, and you wouldn't lie to me, would you? Well, of course they will. Of course they will. And they do. They do so frequently. So ITMFA and, oh yeah, 313-298-WRIF. Welcome to all of you listening in the WRIF immediate listening area, which is southeastern Michigan, particularly the Detroit area, southern Ontario, northern Ohio, and via the internet all across the world, all across the country. A lot of generals, unprecedented in American history, telling Bush to fire Donald Rumsfeld. Now, that's kind of odd. They're saying what a failure he was, how terrible Rumsfeld is. Of course, you know, Bush has lined up some active duty guys to say he's okay. And I think even an ex-chief of staff or something like that. But still, to have seven ex-generals and people of that caliber say that a person running a war as it's going on is a catastrophe for the U.S. military goals and for the men and women fighting it, that has no precedent in American history. No, and we'll get to that a little later as well. Iran, that's still a lot of saber rattling going on around that. Actually, is this short enough? I could probably just, yeah. This is from, man, I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name. He's actually, and he's not a Turk. He's the co-host of the Young Turks, the first liberal radio show to air nationwide. And his name is Cenk Uygur. R-U-G-Y-U. Sometimes this stuff is spelled backwards. What's C-E? That doesn't make any sense. Anyway, we'll call him Cenk Uygur. The name of this was at Huffington Post, reprinted Friday, April 14th, at commondreams.org. And that's a great site, by the way. If you just did one thing, I mean, some of you are saying, "Why? What is this? CIA agents, you know, mobile labs is another lie to Bush's that came out this week that he said, oh, this proves that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. He knew that was a lie. If all of this is, you're going, like, what? Go to commondreams.org every single day, and that'll run it all down. They confront every lie coming out of Washington, expose it, and give you an idea of what is true. All right? And then again, don't accept that uncritically. Think about it. And maybe you need to then do a little more investigating to satisfy yourself. So here's what Cenk Uygur, because this, how could you spell it? U-Y-G-U-R. Uygur. All right, it's called If You Liked the Iraq War, You'll Love the Iran War. And he says, if you like gas at $3 a gallon, we're going to talk about that in just about a second, you'll love it at $5 or more. If you liked fighting 26 million people in Iraq, you'll love fighting 68 million in Iran. If you like turning Sunni Muslims against us, you'll love turning Sunni and Shiite Muslims against us. If you liked war in the Persian Gulf, you'll love war all over the Middle East. If you thought things were bad now, wait till Iran retaliates against our airstrikes by bombing Israel. When Israel strikes back, the whole Middle East will get sucked into the war, and then the fun really starts, he says. Do any of you, he's posing this, Cenk Uygur, we'll call him, but I would to you as well. Do any of you have any confidence that George W. Bush knows what he's doing when he contemplates starting a war with Iran? Do any of you believe he has carefully thought out all the possibilities and has a plan for every contingency? He says, I don't care how Republican you are. That is an inconceivable thought. No one could believe that's true. The man who lost New Orleans and accidentally started a civil war in Iraq is going to have a strong strategy for Iran? He doesn't think so. Bush is a proven liar, whether he's lying about biological weapons labs, leaks from his administration, or warrantless spying. One thing for sure, he cannot be trusted. He has no shame in continually and aggressively lying to the American people. No one could have, well, then he goes on with them all. But the idea that the United States is planning Bush says the idea of bombing Iran is wild speculation. He also said we weren't wiretapping anybody without a court order. He says we're trying diplomacy first. That's exactly what he said about Iraq when we found out he was planning for the war all along. Now, who do you trust more? George Bush or General Anthony Zinni? General Zinni is the former head of the U.S. Central Command. He said he saw no evidence of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction before the war. He thought we didn't have enough troops to get the job done right. And now he thinks going into Iran is even worse an idea. Is there any single American who really believes George Bush knows better than General Zinni? And I would add to that, the other six generals, some of who served under Rumsfeld and Bush in Iraq, others prominent militarists, I'm saying I was going to talk about this later. I will. All right, big day tomorrow, tax day. It's usually the 15th. It fell on a Saturday, so we got a couple more days. All of us hate paying taxes, right? We look at our paycheck, and whether it's $200 a week or $2,000 a week, we see that chunk out of it, and we always go, like that. Maybe a little in the payroll tax. We think we're going to eventually get back for Social Security and Medicare, and that's okay. But generally, we think we're getting ripped off by the government. And particularly, this idea lives on the right wing. But you know what? I think it's spread across the political spectrum. I certainly think that. I don't think that my tax dollars are going to much that I want it to. I should have copied these figures down. But the enormous, you know what? Maybe I do. Oh, yeah. Actually, it's right here in front of me. What do our tax dollars go for? There's some countries, the northern tier Scandinavian countries. We were talking about Finland a few weeks ago, but Sweden and Norway, Denmark as well. They pay really high taxes. The United States pays overall pays among the lowest taxes. In other words, percentage of taxes regarding our total income. But We don't get much for it because we look around. We don't get like a national health program like most countries, all countries besides ours does, of the industrialized country. We look, our schools suck, our roads suck, cities are dangerous, people live in crappy housing, on and on and on and on like that. We don't have enough money to build proper levees in cities like New Orleans that needed it. So where's it all going? Well, it's all going to Bushco military spending, spending for war. That's where this enormous amount goes. So when you think about where your taxes are going, they're not going for what we really want or need. They're going down this rat hole of military spending. And the United States has contrived these enemies for the last 50 years or 60 years now, ever since World War II, to maintain a permanent war economy. If you can go see this movie, Why We Fight, Why We Fight, check it out. It may be available as a DVD. I think it is now. And it's all about General Dwight D. Eisenhower, also the president for two terms, on his last speech, warned about the military-industrial complex. Well, nobody paid any attention to him whatsoever. And that's what we live under now, a military-industrial complex, where essentially our what we work for so hard, whether we're shifting burgers around or signing orders or working in a factory, a shop, office, whatever. We create this wealth and we're paid a part of it as our wages. And then a portion of it is taken from us by the government. And what would be good if it was an orderly way to pay for what it would be, what would work for the general welfare of us. In other words, health program, good roads, good schools, enough cops and firefighters and foresters. I'm thinking about my city when I say, hey, our park's a little messed up and the leaves aren't picked up from last fall. And they say, you know, we've had so many layoffs. And or I go to the post office and I say, how come there's only one window open? And they say, well, we just had more window clerks laid off. They decided there wasn't enough money or whatever, funding for it. So we are essentially being looted. So this money is transferred, this private wealth is transferred through the apparatus of the government. Instead of coming back to us, it goes to the apparatus that produces stuff for war. Well, and then we use it, and that gets all used up, and then they've got to produce more. And so it's this racket, essentially. Anita Dantz. She's the research director of the National Priorities Project, and you can go to nationalpriorities.org, nationalpriorities.org. She said, with the cost of the Iraq war at $315 billion through fiscal year 2006, taxpayers should reflect this tax day on where their money is going. That's enough money to build 18,000 elementary schools across the country and paid more than almost a million teachers to have them taught as long as the war has lasted. If we break that down to the taxpayer cost of just one city, say Houston, Texas, we're talking about $2.2 billion. That's what essentially Houston, Texas share is of this $315 billion that Bush has wasted on this fool's crusade to establish empire and control oil in the Middle East. If that money were spent locally in Houston instead of on the war, every graduating high school student in Houston could have a four-year college scholarship. Free college. Free higher education. And why shouldn't it be that? Why shouldn't we have, given the wealth of this country, why shouldn't we have free higher education? Why is it going up thousands and thousands of dollars? So middle-class families and middle-class students, the only people that can afford to get into these big schools, have to go into major debt. And we talk about, well, hey, we're falling behind in all this educational stuff. So they could, every student in Houston could get a four-year college scholarship. Houston could double the number of police officers, and there would still be hundreds of millions of dollars left for port security, parks, highways, and public works projects, which could hire people at decent wages. She says, with tax day approaching, Americans should realize that for every income tax dollar they pay, 29 cents has gone to the military and only 4 cents for education and just one penny for all of our natural resources in the environment. She asks, is this a sound investment in our country's future? What's your answer? I know what mine is. 313-298-WRIF. You can give your answer. Well, part of it is, hey, some of us fortunate enough to be in the middle class, but that wealth base is beginning to erode, salary base beginning to erode. With a tax break expired, says this article in the New York Times, middle class faces a greater burden for 2006. Did you know this, middle classers? Some of you called me 2 and 3 years ago and said, oh, we're going to get all these tax breaks under Bush. Well, it's expiring. Millions of Americans are rushing to meet the Monday deadline for reporting how much tax they owe on last year's income. A stealth tax increase has begun eating into the 2006 income of nearly 19 million households. Unless Congress takes action, 1 in 4 families with children, up from 1 in 22 last year, wow, will owe up to $3,640 in additional federal income tax come next April. This is very complicated. This is the alternative minimum tax. I don't even want to get into what it's all about. But if you're from a middle-class family or are middle-class in the wage earner, we're going to owe an additional $3,600 a year. And where's it going to go? It's going to go for Bush's war. It's going to go to Bush's daddy's Carlyle group to make more and more money. And we're funding it. That's where it all goes. Money doesn't like appear by magic. So we make it. The government takes it. And Bush gives it to his dad. Or Cheney gives it to his buddies in Halliburton that's still paying him, so to clean up the wreckage that Bush's daddy's firm's weapons have created. This is what I mean. It's a racket. It's a total racket. It's not a government. It's a racket. Bush paid, hey, figure, man, he paid a lot, $187,000 in taxes for 2005. Dick Cheney and his wife made more than 10 times as much as the Bushes, who made $735,000. And so, in other words, where is this figure here? Anyways, he made 10 times more. So he made almost $8 million. Oh, here it is. The Cheneys reported adjusted gross income of nearly almost $9 million. Almost $9 million. And he says they overpaid, so he wants $2 million back. Dick Cheney wants $2 million back. You know, we're going to pay more. So this rich character is going to pay, well, I guess that would, let me see, what would he, I can tell you what they paid. Maybe I can't. But anyways, they want, oh, Cheney's paid $2.5 million in withholding tax, but they want $2 million back. They want $2 million back. So that means they're going to, he's going to pay $1 million on $8 million. Man, it's not very big percentage, is it? Well, That's who the taxes are set up for, the rich. I mean, that's what Bush's so-called tax reform was for. I think most people know that. This article in the business section, which is very sympathetic to the wealthy, in the New York Times a few days ago, big gain for rich seen in tax cuts for investments. I mean, we all have lots of investments, right? No, we don't. The first data to document the effect of President Bush's tax cuts for investment income show that they have significantly lowered the tax burden on the richest Americans, reducing taxes on incomes of more than $10 million by an average of about $500,000. So the tax cuts for investment income show that they have significantly lowered the tax burden on the richest Americans. These are people, you know, sometimes you look at these suburbs like Plymouth, Michigan, or Birmingham, or Pleasant Ridge, or something like that, and you think, those are the rich people. You know, those aren't the rich people. Those are upper middle class people. We're talking about ultra rich who are reaping enormous benefits they don't even need. You've got an income of $10 million. You go, oh, great, I'm going to save $500,000. I mean, they could leave it as a tip in a restaurant or something like that. I actually have this very long story that I'm tempted to read about where some of our tax dollars are going, like in Afghanistan. But let's go to the... So we're being looted by Bushko for his buddies to make war and to repair what the war does in terms of damage. But the other place we're getting directly looted is at the gas pump, right? So let me see if this has gone up any in the last few minutes. The it's at now I'm actually I'm, let me see I'm grabbing the wrong one here futures that's what I all right so it's at $70 a barrel and a lot of time figure how does this translate now it's the same thing $70.55 a barrel of crude. Well, it translates into enormous profits for the CEOs and stockholders of these big oil firms. And I think almost everybody knows about this by now, that he's retired. The retiring chairman of ExxonMobil, Lee Raymond, got the most generous retirement package in history, nearly $400 million, including pension, stock options, other perks, such as a $1 million consulting deal. He's getting $400 million, but he still wants $1 million a year to consult ExxonMobil. I mean, what in the world is he going to do? I mean, is he going to buy Guyana in South America or something like that? He needs a little bit more. He has more than I don't know, $400 million. That'd be curious to how many. Anybody do the math on that? Say like the, I think the average or the median wage is something like say $30,000. So how? Give me a $400 million, $30,000. How many? I can't figure out what I'm trying to figure out. I mean, these are sums of such magnitude. But if you think about it, they're all about gas going up from $1.29 a gallon to what's it at now, like $2.79, and going to be over $3. And one of the things, someone said, how can they do that? How, in the midst of this public indignation about soaring gas prices, how can these greedy son of a bitches all of a sudden announce they're going to give this one man $400 million that each and every one of us paid into? That's where they're getting this money from. And I heard this right winger, a host, saying he's probably worth a lot more. yeah, sure. He's managed to successfully gouge all of us, not had his office stormed by mobs of angry consumers. So yeah, to them, maybe he's worth $500 million. Maybe they ought to put another $100 million on it. Well, someone said, how could they have the arrogance or the stupidity, the public relations stupidity to announce right now that he's going to get $400 million, Lee Raymond, the retiring chairman of ExxonMobil. You know how they do it? They know we're not going to do anything. They know all these politicians are bought and paid for. They know the president's their buddy. They know Dick Cheney's their buddy. They know nothing's going to happen, so it doesn't matter. What the hell? They're spitting in our face. They're rubbing our nose in it. They don't care. Or maybe they're not even doing that. Maybe they don't even think about the little people in our democratic system. Well, we have no democratic control of the economy whatsoever. So these people can gouge us, loot us, steal from us, and there's little or no reaction. You see, around issues of energy, and I don't know if we include water in that, but gas and oil and water in some of these South American countries, and suddenly there's millions of people in the street. They're blocking highways. They're saying, you're not selling off our country to these foreign investors. You're not making water a commodity that we're going to have to pay for. We are taking direct action because our politicians will do nothing. Well, what happens? One of two things. All of a sudden, the politicians go, yeah, right. You know, yeah, I speak for the people. Suddenly, after years of being in the pocket of the looters, he suddenly becomes, this is, kind of a composite of politicians everywhere. They becomes the spokesperson for public anger. Or what happened in Bolivia, they just got rid of the president and put in somebody that promised to speak for the people's needs. All right, so one of the ways that people have been planning to respond to this, and this is fairly decent, but this has been all over the place, that there ought to be a year's boycott of ExxonMobil. That there was, for instance, one day when people weren't going to buy gas at all. Well, that didn't hurt them. They knew then our tanks would be that much lower and we had to fill them up the next day, so it didn't matter. And so here's the idea, writes 20 people have sent me. For the rest of the year, don't purchase any gasoline from the two biggest companies, which are now one, Exxon and Mobil. They are not selling, if they are not selling any gas, they'll be inclined to reduce their prices. If they reduce their prices, the other companies will have to follow suit. But to have an impact, we need to reach literally millions of Exxon and Mobil gas buyers. It's simple to do, saying just to send this out. If this makes sense to you, they say, please pass this message on. I suggest that we not buy from ExxonMobil till they lower their prices to the $1.30 range and keep them down. This can really work. All right. Well, you know, here's what I've been writing back to these people. Put in there that there should be an alternative as well. Because some people say, well, I don't want to buy from Shell because it's all Saudi oil. It's all Middle Eastern oil. That's what the damn war is about, right? Empire and oil. That's it. You hear other stuff, other kind of conspiratorial nutso reasons for the war in Iraq. Understand that it's not about that. It's not about that. It's about oil. It's about empire. It's about controlling resources in a way that's just bound to create more wars, more terrorism, more death, more destruction, more chaos. They profit from this. Not that they really care. I mean, you and I, 99% of the world wants everything calm, peaceful. We want security. But, you know, the ultra-rich, the rulers, they have that all the time. But it's kind of juice, too. They say, all right, there's going to be, you know, this and that. And they go, oh, they rush to the Situation Room. But they never suffer the results of it. If gas goes up to $18 a gallon, it doesn't hurt the rich. You know, because they just got a $500,000 tax break from Bush, for one thing. They can pay for it. They don't get bombed, as a rule. They don't get, you know, they don't suffer the consequences of all the failures of their policies. So if you have a war in Iraq, it's a Sunni man and his family that get wiped out with an errant U.S. bomb, or it's a kid from Texas. And one from Michigan that gets Marines that get killed by a roadside bomb. That's who suffers the consequences of these failed policies. So here's what I would suggest. If people can get this all together for this year-long boycott of ExxonMobil, that's fine. That's fine. I haven't sent it out yet. I don't know. Is that the kind of thing you'll bring bad luck to yourself if you don't send it along? But the other thing is buy from Citgo. Buy from Citgo. Citgo gasoline, Citgo oil, is owned by the Venezuelan government. Now, some of you have bought into the Bush BS that Hugo Chavez is a really bad guy. That's beside the point, whether he's good, bad, or neutral. All of the profits of ExxonMobil, like all the rest of the companies that we buy for, go to wealthy stockholders. That's where all the money goes. That's why Lee Raymond, the chair of ExxonMobil, can get a almost $500 million retirement pay. Hey, a lot of us in the middle class and a lot of us in the working class that sweated their butts off in factories and spent years in offices that thought we were going to get a nice retirement plan aren't going to get it. Aren't going to get it. But these folks that are reaping the rewards from us having to pay more money at the gas pump, well, they're doing just fine. They're secure. Now, here is what's going on with Citgo. There are no stockholders. It's owned by the Venezuelan government. So what happens with the profits? The profits go first and foremost into improving the lot of the poor in Venezuela. So that's what happens. When you pay $2.79, they're not having the gas any lower. At $2.79, well, let's put it the other way first. ExxonMobil, you're paying Lee Raymond's inflated, bloated retirement fee. Not fee, what would you call it? Retirement plan. When it goes to Citgo, it goes to alleviate some terrible poverty in Caracas or some of the other cities there, some of which I saw with my own eyes when I was down there. I mean, it was frightening, some of the conditions. And you remember, things have been improving greatly in Venezuela, and things are still bad for the poor. At least they've got good food. Now they've got medical, things they never had before, because all the money from the state enterprise before went to the rich in Venezuela. But Chavez, whatever you may think of him, whatever I may think of him, and I have some criticisms of him, which I'm not even going to get into, things have changed now. So Venezuela's oil wealth and what is going to help the poor, and also, remember, we've talked about this, some of it has gone to help the poor in the United States by reduced fuel oil prices. Chavez is giving reduced oil prices to Caribbean nations. and the Venezuelan rich are going crazy. He's a communist. He's helping the poor. Because before, Venezuelan oil, just like U.S. oil, only helped the rich. In Hugo Chavez's country, oil profits help the poor. In the United States, oil profits make people poor. I mean, again, if you're making lots of money, another buck at the pump doesn't matter that much. You're making 20 grand a year, 18 grand a year. You got making 23 grand a year and you have a wife and two kids and all of a sudden gas is a buck more a gallon. You got to, I know people that drive to like Saginaw for work because that's the only place they could get work. What do you think that's doing to their budgets? Now, Chavez is also seeking to peg oil at 50 bucks a barrel. That'd be down $20 from what it is. And he says it's not a low price, but it's a fair price. And, of course, what he's interested in is not getting you and I the rock-bottom price, like that thing was talking about, what was it, $1.30 a gallon. He wants it, and there's, again, it's all kind of complicated, the politics of oil and the economics of oil and the type of oil that is available in Venezuela. It's all very complicated. But 50 bucks a barrel and keep it there. That's what he's advocating. So in all of this, including the few conservatives and few Republicans that are and few Bush supporters that are still left on the planet, who's the good guy in this? George Bush, who defends the profits of ExxonMobil, or Hugo Chavez, who wants to reduce oil world oil prices $20 and help the poor people, first and foremost, in his country, and some of it would help ours as well. All right. Whew. All right, your turn. 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back to get your calls.
Hear the best rock the Motor City has to offer before they hit it big. Motor City Riff. Every Sunday night at 10. It's loud. It's local. And no friggin' satellite can give you the best local band. Like the station that supports local rock. 101-WRIF. Everything that rocks. Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Damn, that was quick, wasn't it? Well, welcome back. 313-298-WRIF. Some open lines, and I didn't ask you any questions, but I would like your comments. Neil Young's got a brand new album out called Living with War, and one track says it all, according to this account in the London Independent. Impeach the President. That's right. ITMFA. You want to know what that means? Go to my website, peterwerby.com, PeterWerbe.com. And also emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Let's go to Neil's in Ann Arbor. Neil, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, I love the show, Peter. Been listening for years, and I hate Sundays when you're not on.
So. Well, I'm here most days. Thanks. Thanks for joining us.
I always agree with almost everything you say, if not everything. Just the one clarification, though, you're talking about taxes in the post office. Since the Postal Reorganization Act of 74, we've been on our own. We run the whole ship just by selling stamps and services. So if people out there think that their tax money is being wasted, or they look and they see a mailman and they go, oh, he's not working hard enough, where's my tax money? That's actually not the case in 74.
Okay.
And actually, the government actually dips into our coffers whenever we show any kind of extra money. So that's how that works, unfortunately.
All right.
But I just want to throw that out there.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the correction. I always want to be accurate. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Yeah.
All right.
I was reading earlier. Let me see if I can go back to this. I was The show, The Young Turks, actually, according to Cynthia listening in Pittsburgh, says that, now I've lost it. Remember I was reading that and I couldn't pronounce the man's name? What do I do with these things? They just get eaten? He's Turkish, and that's why his show is called The Young Turks, because that's also, Young Turks also mean, it's kind of a phrase that means like a rebel or something. You say these people are the Young Turks of the industry. It means new, innovative, young people involved. So apparently the name is pronounced, the first name at least, C-E-N-K, is pronounced Cenk. Cenk Uygur. Maybe I've got that right. All right. Thanks, Cynthia. And let's go back to our phone. 313-298-WRIF. And here's Lee. Lee's listening in. Taylor, go ahead, Lee. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I would like you to explain how the poor of the population pay the most in taxes.
What do you mean?
Well, basically, I would like to know like how the poor is basically paying the most other than the rich in taxes.
Well, I don't know that the poor is. The lower you are on the tax schedule, generally the more fully you pay the maximum that would be in your bracket. I mean, the poor don't pay a lot of income tax per se. They pay payroll tax, for instance.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. Is that answering your question?
Sort of. I was more or less wondering of like how much the poor pay before how much the rich pay, and what the big loop was. Like, is in reality, is the poor paying more in taxes per se at the end of the year versus the rich paying the most at the end of the year?
Well, the poor, if you're actually poor, if you're making like say $13,000 a year, you're not paying any tax. In fact, I think there's even a negative tax where they can get money back. But if you start, if you're somebody like Dick Cheney, who made like $8 million, and he thinks he should only pay $1 million in taxes. So that's, what, about 12.5%. So probably the absolute maximum within his schedule, I don't even know what it is anymore. Say it's only a third. It used to be a lot more. But say it's only a third. Well, if he, because of all these exemptions that the politicians have put in for their kindred souls, the wealthy, so he's going to wind up paying 12.5%. So, as you go down the income range, there's less and less exemptions, and people pay more and more of their schedule. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it's hard to explain, but that's probably about the best I can do for you. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
Yes, thank you. That helps me out a lot.
All right, bye bye now. In fact, if somebody really has a handle on how all this works, like I was just talking about, please, I'm sure someone can explain that a lot better than I can. Accountants? Oh, man, no. There's no accountants listening, are there? I mean, can you do, because this is the last day, so the accountants that I know, both in New York, if you're listening, and I'll see you soon. And if you're here in Detroit, thank you for doing my taxes early. But they're probably going to be working till the early hours of the morning, getting those last minute tax returns in. So if you guys can give me a call and explain that. And so why did I say to someone in New York I would see him soon? Pardon me. Because dear wife and I are heading off to New York City to attend the Saturday, April 29th, anti-war demonstration. It's going to be a big one. They're looking again for 1 million people to say, get out of Iraq, end the war, no war against Iran. And although most of the people at these, for instance, I suspect it'll probably be about 85% of the people that are attending will be from the New York region, there's lots of us that come in. I'm actually going to probably come in on Wednesday and leave Sunday, get back here. But there's also buses going. Probably only a few of you have ever done that. What happens, people get on buses Friday night, travel all night, sleep on the bus if you can. Mostly it's just a lot of goofing off, as I remember. And then you get there in the morning, you take part in all the festivities and the big demonstration and the march and what have you. Boom, you get on the bus and you get back. When would you get back? Probably late Saturday. If you're interested in doing that, it's an extraordinary experience. I remember them fondly. I guess, what can I say, from my early youth or something like that? There, the buses are still going. If you go to my website, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com, you'll go over to, to the calendar page, which is a good place to find out about events in any event. Go to the calendar page, click on it, and you'll see where you can, how you can get hooked up with these buses and go there. I would highly recommend it. Or if you can just, go to the website, peterwerbe.com, and click on the first icon or logo on the top, and it'll tell you all the details. Drive there. That's another thing we used to do. Pile in the car, get five or six of us in a car. Take what was necessary. You can figure that one out. Take what was necessary and arrive usually in Washington. Arrive usually in Washington, D.C. for these great marches on Washington that have a tradition going back near to 100 years in the Constitution, redress of grievances and what have you. There's going to be a labor contingent, and as a longtime union member of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFTRA, there's going to be a labor contingent at 10:30 a.m., 19th Street between Broadway and Park Avenue. So I'm going to be there as well. Some open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Mark. Mark, where are you calling from?
I'm from Howell, actually.
Howell. Yeah.
Proud UAW member for Ford Motor Company. I meant to usually would put me in your camp, but unfortunately it does not.
What's that?
I just how do you get through the night, Peter? I just, some of the stuff you spew is just the same old kind of crap that they put on the TV. Well, it's just all the highlights. It's a bad war, it's a made up war. If we just take the military spending and get new health care, to pay for health care for everybody like the rest of the world. The rest of the world comes to the United States to get their health care. Now,
where'd you learn the way you've been? Turn off, if you're a union member, turn off O'Reilly. Don't listen to him. He's filling your head with BS.
What, a union member? Union members are all, union members are all Democratic liberals that think that the government's going to save their, I don't know what they think.
Well, I'll tell you, the government probably won't save anything. The government is probably going to let, beginning with the mistakes that your employer made, of course, whereas guys like you worked your butt off, rather than saving you, they're going to try to save the corporation so that they can continue to make millions for their stockholders and for the CEOs, and it's going to be screw Mark and his UAW buddies.
Now, Peter, that's what a business does. And if that's what they do, then I've got two choices. I can cry and go to the government and say, gee, what can you do for me? Or I can get off my dead ass and find a different way to make money.
You know what, Mark? You're not going to be able to. You're not going to be able to, because you know what is happening? All these retraining programs. You're the boss's friend. You're just and rather than having solidarity with your fellow workers, solidarity, what typifies the human species, you're some mutant, man.
A mutant
of the human species, because you don't know what your own self-interest is. You identify with the people that are screwing you.
Well, if they screw me, they screw me. Right now I'm making a boatload of money, and I'm going to make my money, and I'm keeping my eyes up. I'm not waiting for the government to take care of my pension. I'm not waiting for Social Security to kick in when I get older. I mean, I was born...
Well, so it's every man for himself, right? That's what I mean. So the whole idea of human solidarity, of community, of people taking care of one another as what defines the species... It's just the war of all against all, right?
Are we taking care of the people in Uganda that are getting genocide with all the little tribal wars?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's so many problems around the world, but they all have the same. They all have the same root. We've got 800 men that have an accumulated wealth of almost $2 trillion, where people are losing their pensions, and people shouldn't cry. People should maybe occupy the factory or something like they did in Argentina. Get a clue, man, how to fight this.
Do we always begrudge the people that make more money? Isn't that what?
Well, it's not a matter of making more money. It's a matter again of what everything. Wasn't there a book a while ago called Everything I Know I Learned in Kindergarten? Like, if you don't have something to to share. You don't eat it by yourself in class. And when people are in desperate straits, people that work their butts off, people that work in wherever you work alongside of you, do everything that they're told to do by the rich people that make the policy, and then you find out some guy is getting $400 million after screwing the average consumer, and that's fine with you. And you're saying
so,
I shouldn't resent
them. So what do you
do? Well, I'll tell you what you should do. We should organize to completely change the tax structure in this country, that there ought to be, say, maybe over $5 million, a 90% tax on income, and start using the wealth that people like you, Mark, and the rest of the people that work in this country produce and use it for us, not allowing it to go to this accumulation of obscene wealth that people can't possibly ever consume. Come on, man. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Steve in Pinckney. Go ahead, Steve. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Listen, I usually agree with you a lot, but I got to part company with you tonight. This idea that a lot of people have about shareholders, that somehow the money they make is unearned, or that people who own stock are rich and don't deserve it, is nuts, and it shows a fundamental misunderstanding of how the economy works.
Well, I know how the economy works. We work our butts off, and increasingly we get less and less, and the people that own get more and more. It's called rich get richer, poor get poorer. But now what's happening is the middle class is beginning to join that process in this spiral downward.
No, I think the middle class is being undercut by globalization. Well, that's another topic.
Well, wait a minute. But who benefits from globalization? Do you think it might be these, let me be accurate, these 793 billionaires? Do you think there's any connection between globalization and their individual wealth?
Of course, corporate wealth benefits from globalization. But
sure.
Who buys into it? Every time these people who work at assembly line walk into a Walmart and buy a cheap TV, what they're really saying is, I believe I'm making dollars a day. You know, but they don't care. They undercut themselves that way. But I got to.
Well, wait. What are they going to do? I mean, I don't buy at Walmart. Say you go to Costco. You're still buying essentially from the same place, although Costco is a decent place to work and it's unionized, and they try to do the best by their workers as opposed to Walmart that tries to do the worst by them.
When you buy those products, you're putting your stamp of approval on it, so it's very hypocritical of people like you or a lot of people I know who shop at Walmart.
I don't shop at Walmart. Listen, if everybody shopped like me, probably the economy would collapse. I don't buy hardly anything. I've got everything I want.
Well, frankly, I mean, this is not what I call to talk about, but myself, I don't want to buy that cheap crap from China. I'm prepared to live in the Stone Age if I have to.
Well, I think we're the same way, but the system depends on rampant consumerism. Look, what you can have, let's say we're talking about a capitalist model here. We're not talking revolution. We're not talking socialism. We're not talking communism. We're talking about capitalism. And the amount of wealth that is produced by us as working people at different levels, some of us are making $12,000, some of us are making, $120,000. But we're working. So we create wealth by our labor. And then it can be split up in any number of ways. And one of the ways that GM could have not be facing what it's facing, and Union or Delphi could not be facing, if they would have returned less on investment and not taken all that amount of money that they made and distributed it all. Well, the same thing could be economy-wide, that salaries could be doubled, particularly for people making, say, under $50,000 a year, and the people that and so poor Lee Raymond wouldn't get a $400 million retirement package. Maybe the poor son of a bitch would only get like a $2 million retirement package.
Well, Peter, am I still with you?
You're with me.
I agree with you. CEO salaries are out of hand, but what the tone of your conversation indicates is that you don't understand that
it isn't just workman's labor that creates wealth. It's also capital and investment. I myself am a person who came out of poverty. I've worked for 30 years. I have money. I own stock in Exxon, as well as many other companies. And I'm taking a risk, and I'm putting my wealth out there, as many other people are. And there's nothing wrong with distributing some of those profits, a lot of those profits, to shareholders.
Well, that's just what I said. It just depends at what return on investment. For all I know, I have, you know, I just have one of these, you know, a 401k with a, what are the, I don't even know what the hell they are, money market account or something. So maybe I have stock in ExxonMobil as well. I don't know that. But, I mean, it's a question. Do we want to live in a world that's constructed like this, where we're going to be faced with the consequences of poverty, of war, of mass disease, of total or of a continuing insecurity? And we can, I mean, I love being out around Pinckney. I mean, you can kind of hide in those circumstances, but probably then you start finding out there's, you know, a guy, a young man been killed from the area, and then you know, who knows if Bush decides to invade Iran, so pump up his poll numbers before the elections. There'll be another terrorist attack on the United States. Now I am saying goodbye. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Let's stay around Howell and talk to Jim. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air, Jim. Jim.
Hey, sorry. I just wanted to comment on your oil prices and your issues there.
Sure.
That I completely agree with you on that. I'm very young, just started. I work for a tier one supplier, automotive. And I'm working in Troy, I live in Howell. It's getting very hard for me to get back to work, so I'm moving to Troy in the next couple of weeks, and I just bought a motorcycle to try to alleviate that a little bit.
Well, that'll work for by the next 6 or 7 months.
Yeah, maybe.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Maybe.
Yeah.
And I think it's ridiculous that $400 million retirement contract and we're paying how much the pumps?
Yeah, well, I don't know. As I it could go up before our very eyes. I keep watching it. Nope, still the same thing. $70 a gallon, yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's like the weather in Michigan. It changes every 10 minutes.
Yeah, well, it doesn't. Well, it's, see, it'll go up. I mean, this is the deal. All of a sudden, it'll hit $3, and everybody will really start screaming. It'll be the first item on the news. And then miraculously, they'll go, all right, we found more, or we're pumping more, or we're refining more, or something, and it'll be $2.65 a gallon instead of $3.15, and we'll go, okay, that's okay. But they keep, you know, each time it goes down a little, then it goes up again, because they're waiting to see what we'll do, and we don't do anything. So the question is, and people are probably all saying, and I'm asking the same question, what does that mean? What can we do? I mean, if someone said, all right, let's fight high oil prices tomorrow morning, and we'll all, because the form of combating this is not in front of us right now. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do. You don't know what to do. But it's going to present itself. And some of these guys, like some of the people we've heard from, they're going to be defending the right, and they're ordinary working people, union people, and they're going to be defending the right of the bosses to rip off ordinary working people, middle class and working class people. I don't know where that's coming from. I mean, they're paying more. It's not like they're, because they're the friends of the boss, that they're going to pay less at the pump. They're going to pay the same amount. But for some reason or other, they're willing to eat it. I don't understand that. I mean, these are usually people with those attitudes are usually pretty aggressive and pretty confrontational on a personal level. But when it comes to confronting authority, even just questioning authority, let alone confronting it and undertaking a struggle, they're not there. They turn into little kids. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Let me see if we can get this one right here. It's Matt in Marysville. Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, Pete. How are you?
Good. I take the little car ferry in your town every once in a while.
Oh, okay, got you. Cool. Hey, I don't got much time before I got to go and make the boss a couple $1 million myself, but I did do the math over the weekend. And Mr. Raymond there got $17,600 a day every day since he got slapped on the ass all the way up through retirement, so that's not too bad.
Wow.
Yeah. And I also noticed on the news that Mr. Cheney, on his income tax return, from my understanding, he actually overpaid. He got a $2 million return.
That's what he says, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of depressing, man. People, to me, need to wake up, obviously. I mean, when somebody gets $17,000 a day, and that happens in the medical industry and many other industries, everybody needs to wake up, stop fighting each other.
Well, I'll tell you, Matt, here someone just sent me this email. Brian wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Kind of long. He says, I'm one of those evil right-wing Christian conservatives who votes Republican all the way. But he says, the thing I disagree with you most, taking aim at successful executives. It feels like you're... if people are so wealthy, it's because they and their forefathers put successful financial plans together that has enabled them to experience the greatest financial success possible. Well, it's not exactly the way it goes down. What it means is, yeah, well, in a way, you know, yeah, they figured out that they can keep raising the prices way beyond their rising costs and essentially rip us all off. So this is, it's what I said to that one guy from Howell, the union member. It's dog-eat-dog, war of all against all, rather than understanding that we have a, you know, mutual interest because we essentially all want the same thing out of life. I mean, sure, the people like to maximize their income, but to say the people that can't, screw them. I mean, that's not a very charitable, or if you will, according to this guy, speaking to him, a very Christian way to live life in a country and in a world that doesn't have to be suffering everything it does. All right, I got to do some, just actually about 120 seconds. Be right back with you. 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
313-298-WRIF. I'd like to hear from you. Let's see here. Some email, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Man, listen, where this guy is calling from Saipan. Isn't that an island? Isn't that one of the places where they fought? I believe so. Yeah, it's an island in the middle of the Pacific. Greg is listening there. He said, I'm not able to catch you live. Too many time zones between us. I got this from a friend about how much... So how's he emailing me now? I don't get it. Anyways, I got this from a friend about how much the CEO class has benefited from the wars Bush is fighting. The ratio of average CEO pay, now $11.8 million to worker pay, $27,460, spiked from 301-1 in 2003 to 431-1 in 2004. So you get that? So the average CEO is now of these big companies is making about $12 million a year. So in 2 years, you know, you've got almost $25 million. So again, this is wealth that's parked that does nothing. If this was distributed in a manner that, say, pumped the average worker pay, or the median, I don't know which this is, from 27,460 up about 3,000 or 4,000, what would those people do with it, making that level of income? They'd spend it all. Wouldn't that juice the economy? So these people, they don't even really, I don't even get it. I mean, it's one thing to be greedy. You know, I was saying, a lot of people are just like, screw the other person. If other person doesn't make it, too bad. And if they're losing their pension, who cares? And what have you. But it's not like, I want to get all of mine. I want the biggest house. I want all these expensive cars. I want, you know, expensive watches and real expensive clothing and a second house and all that. Well, you can be greedy, and what does that take? $2-3 million a year, and you can almost have it all. So what happens when you're making $12 million a year, let alone $100 million a year? It's all status. And so much of this is, what did they call that? Conspicuous consumption. What was his name? I almost said Thorzine. That couldn't be his first name. Man, I'm forgetting it all. Some guy around 1900. Who made that? Somebody write me in about that. I keep thinking Thorstein Veblen or something. Veblen, that was it. Not Thorazine. That's some drug. I'm going to need some. All right, there was another one, too. Here, this is Tom writing in from, I think, Ann Arbor. At calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Just to clarify for you, current median household annual income is about 40. This is a household, 42,000 a year. Let's call it 40K. So Mr. Raymond's retirement package is worth 10,000 times the median household annual income. Now, that is a bit unfair of a comparison, since Mr. Raymond's retirement package is supposed to cover him until his death. So let's say he lives for 25 more years. That means the simple average payment per year from his retirement plan is basically 400 times the median household annual income. Man, that's just, just for giggles, if the above 25-year estimate holds true, Mr. Raymond would get a monthly pension check of about $3 million a month, because and you know, hey, these companies, they're not charity organizations. They think that Lee Raymond was able to screw the public enough that he's worth being rewarded that much. It's that simple. Okay, let's go to Brian. Brian's in Brighton. Brian, hi, it's Peter Werbe here on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, longtime listener. Love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, one thing I noticed that nobody's ever really brought up, but are you familiar with the minimum wage increase that's coming up?
In Michigan?
Yes.
Yeah, actually I am. So tell us more about it.
Well, I believe it's by October 1st of this year, it's going to go up to $6.85 per hour. In 2007, July 1st, it goes up to $7.15. July 1st in 2008, it goes up to $7.40. Now, honestly, I haven't had the opportunity to go online and check and see how the other states are at and so on and so forth, but, you know, I work in the food service industry, and to be quite honest, you know, we're all kind of scrambling trying to make sure that the scale in the restaurant is going to be, you know, kind of easing into it, but on a global sense, I guess, best we could say, granted, it's only in Michigan. I mean, we're looking at, like, let's say, for instance, a restaurant or a business that's a little bit slower, a little less volume, that's going to end up shutting down because they have to compensate the fact that minimum wage is coming up, and so that should affect the scale all the way across the board.
Well, often the argument against raising the minimum wage, in fact, it's the constant one, although this was weird. The Republicans actually backed this raising the minimum wage here in Michigan. But the argument always is that it won't make any difference, that the people will then have to raise their prices. That's one of the, there's two arguments. One, that they'll have to raise their prices so that the wage increases won't even amount to anything. And the other is that marginal businesses or small businesses won't be able to make the payroll, and it'll actually wind up in a loss of jobs. Well, that's the blackmail theory, that we as workers have to keep accepting low wages or there's going to be dire consequences like higher prices that will negate the rise in wages, or we'll lose our jobs. We could make the argument that more people would be in business if we paid people $3 an hour. We didn't even have a minimum wage. We just let the market control it. Or $2 an hour. And then it's beginning to sound a lot like third world countries. So I think what we have to really say, that if you want to be in business, and this could sound harsh to some people, because I know small businessmen, and they're having lots of trouble. But if you can't pay people a living wage, not a minimum wage, but a living wage, maybe you shouldn't be in business.
True. Very true.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us. Let's see. Steve's in Hazel Park. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby here with you.
Hey, Pete.
Hi.
This is Steve.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, I just wanted to congratulate you for, you're dead on. I mean, you are dead on your take on what's going on in the country today.
Well, thank you.
Not enough people call, and, you know, they always want to be combative. So I just wanted to call and say, you know, kudos to you.
Well, Steve, I appreciate that. Thanks for joining me. It's nice to hear that. But, people that want to disagree, give me a hard time. Same deal, 313-298-WRIF. Thanks, Steve. Here is, an email. Joe's listening in Long Beach, California. He talks about, we're talking about taxes and what percentage, do we pay. There's supposed to be a progressive tax. The more you make, the more amount of taxes, that was the original theory, the more taxes you pay. Well, that's going the other way now. And then, it's progressive taxes, like I said just now. But there's also what they call regressive tax. Regressive tax is like the sales tax. So no matter what your income is, you pay the same thing. That sounds fair. Everybody pays the same thing. So if you're a millionaire, you pay 6%. And if you're making $15,000 a year, you should be, you pay 6%. Well, of course, it hurts the person making terrible wages a lot, tremendously more than someone who's making really high wages. So Joe writes in about all taxes, all the hidden taxes, hotel tax, cigarette tax, numerous taxes on phone and utility bills, sales tax, state and federal gas taxes, car rental tax, lottery, toll roads, et cetera, et cetera. The net result is reducing the progressive, income tax system in favor of the higher income brackets and against the lower brackets. Keep in mind, the Bush tax cut turned our tax surplus into a deficit. The tax cut was a tax shift. Right now, see, we didn't owe anything. You know, think about those of you who are lucky enough to owe nothing on your credit card. All right, you know a few people. You know me. I pay off every month, no matter how much it is. I'll even go into my savings rather than pay these usurers, the interest they want. I know some of you can't help it. Some of you just ought to be a little more cautious, excuse me for saying the obvious, a little cautious in your purchases. Other people are getting by through their credit cards. And it's like paying the mafia because you start paying 18%. You know, I don't think they break your legs, but they can exact quite a bit. But Bush drove us into deficit. It was like, imagine this, we're all a family, right? We're all Americans. We are this one big family. And before, Dad ran the family on a fiscal basis. He understood what his income was for the family. We're just the kids. We're just the kids, and old-fashioned. The wife doesn't work or anything like that. So it's we're dependents. And so Dad is making the income. And when he decides to make a purchase, he decides if we can afford it. And if we can't afford it, he doesn't spend it. But one of the things he doesn't do, he doesn't go out and gamble lots of it, and he doesn't make bad loans to people so that we wind up owing money. That's exactly what's happened in the United States now. So Joe from Long Beach writes in, exactly now, because that we've been driven into becoming a debtor nation. And I don't know why this doesn't, some conservatives have reacted real negatively. But remember, they're always about fiscal responsibility and balanced budget. So Bush giving away these tax cuts, two things, tax cuts to the wealthy and this, this insane war, which is getting even more insane every day. It was just little notes. Oh, four Marines dead. Oh, okay. What, you know, how'd the Tigers do? And these, anyway. This war is costing hundreds of billions of dollars. So now, between the tax cuts, rather than raising taxes on the wealthy to pay for the war that they're benefiting from, he reduces taxes on the wealthy and starts off on this insane war based on lies. So now, according to Joe, and I think this is correct, the per capita, each person, each one of us owes $28,000 or $112,000 for a family of four. So what that means, I've said this any number of times, maybe if I say it enough or some of you haven't heard it before, that means when you make $500 in a week and you get $400, that would you get probably about, four, hopefully, about $400. Some percentage of maybe 25 bucks of that 100 that they're taking, $25 of it is going to the war and the war suppliers and, you know, Bush's buddies and family and all that. His uncle Bucky, who made a fortune off the war. And then another part of it is going to pay the interest. You know that from your credit card. So Bush drove us into debt. And you know what? See, it doesn't drive him into debt. It doesn't drive his class buddies, the ruling class buddies, the ultra wealthy into debt. That makes them money. Who's paying the freight is you and me, the middle class and the working class. That's who's paying it all. And we're paying it for them. And then I get these people go, oh, well, so, you know, I mean, why aren't they leading the revolt? I don't understand that one little bit. All right. Lessie, here is Joe. Joe's calling from Plymouth, Canton. Hi, Joe, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter, how you doing this evening?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, I'm one of those highly educated individuals out here in Canton. Now, I am fully with you, man. I think our public and our middle class are slowly shrinking and really missing the ball on a large number of issues.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I developed, you know, my own perspective over the last couple of years. And one of the things, you know, we really got to take a look at that free trade issue that just keeps hanging out. We keep hearing, you know, we got to get into the free trade and how it's benefiting business. But what is it really doing at the consumer level? I mean, how many times do we walk into some place like Walmart and we're able to negotiate some free trade? I mean, is there anything really free about it?
No. Supposedly we get lower prices out of it, but it's part of the process where we also get lower wages and certainly the people that are working in other countries to provide those lower priced items for us are getting screwed horribly.
Oh my God, they're getting killed.
Yeah.
But the point that I'm really trying to make is, I mean, just think if we had our big basket full of groceries and all the goodies that we just bought, and after it was all rung up, we looked at the and we requested to speak to the manager, and we said, you know, I want to get some of this free trade. I want to get 10% or 20% of this. How about a 20% discount across the board?
Yeah. Well, yeah. He'd say, hey, man, I'm just a working stiff just like you, and I can barely hold it together on the wages that I'm getting paid here, and he'd be right. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. So we'll see whether I said this all right. Nick, writing in from Imlay City, wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I was talking about the conspicuous consumption on the part of the wealthy. It was American economist Thorstein Veblen. I kind of fractured his name, but I think I got pretty close. Not Thorazine, that's for sure. Thorstein Veblen, who coined the term in his Theory of the Leisure Class. The term is used to describe the consumption of expensive goods, commodities, and services for the sake of displaying social status and wealth. In other words, greed. Love the show. Thank you. You're absolutely right. And so was old Thorazine. Let's see. David. David, you're on the air. Peter Werby. Where are you calling from?
Dearborn.
No, go ahead. You're on the air.
Two things real quick. I sent you an email a couple weeks ago about a book called Sky Chips. And it's a government program and how they're going to control the food, basically. And when you can control the food, you control the population.
Yeah, send it to me again. I really try to read everything. I have no memory of that.
Okay. What I really wanted to call about was, you know, you're talking about, you know, corporate wealth and, you know, screw the average person. My wife's cousin lives on the other side of Grand Rapids. Her husband works for Delphi as a GM transfer. He's been there for a long time. They have a son. He's 8 years old. The son's dying of aplastic anemia.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, because the father works for Delphi, they're going to lose their health insurance. They're going to lose their pension and everything else. And the family's getting, you know, free assistance with this illness, but it's like every 2 or 3 months they have to fly here for this transfusion, they have to fly here for this operation, they have to fly mm-hmm. here. And, you know, most people, when they hear the stories, oh, well, you know, they can go find another job. They don't realize that there are actual people who are suffering at the other end.
Sure, and also, I mean, the whole idea that, pardon me, the lack of compassion that people have for these people that worked at Delphi and other places that are, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of American workers have been laid off. And you get these cold-hearted conservatives that just say, well, it's their fault. They didn't think to get retrained. Well, who the hell thinks they're going to get retrained? I don't, you know, what am I supposed to get retrained in? I mean, I probably, if I lost my job here, I could probably get another job in industry. But if you're 52 years old, and you've been a faithful employee of an industrial company, and to think that you're going to get retrained. I was just reading an article about retraining. They have these seminars for all these pilots that were, it wasn't in pilots. It was industrial, airline service mechanics. The guys that we depend on, you know, to make sure that these damn planes are as safe and secure as they are. And so these companies are laying them off, and, you know, instead of having these union workers, they're getting, you know, now cheapest bid non-union labor. And so they're telling these guys, you can get retrained as what? And, you know, so it's not out there. I mean,
well, you know, my uncle worked for GM for 32 years. And every year after I graduated from high school, he'd call me and offer to get me a job at GM. Tell him, I don't want it. There's no way. You know, I've called a couple times before. I'm a medic. I don't make as much money as someone working at GM, but I've got job security basically. And he was skilled trade. He with overtime, he made a six-figure salary, but he was also laid off 5 times. His last layoff was 5 years.
Wow.
You know, and he went from making like $100-some thousand a year driving a cab at $20,000 a year, waiting for GM to call him back. And as soon, and not to say I told you so, but as soon as Clinton signed NAFTA, I knew this stuff was coming.
Sure.
There's no way I was going to take a factory job. Yeah, the money's good for a while, but, you know, when you're laid off, you're fired, you go through the money you've saved. Now what are you going to do?
Yeah, well, and now I don't think that there's a person in America that's thinking about things that feels their job is 100% secure. I'll bet
True.
Even, you know, you talked about wanting to have that security, David, but I'll suspect you don't feel 100% secure.
No, not really.
Yeah.
I've got some skills. If I lose my job here, I can go get a job as another medic.
Yeah.
The salaries are basically the same. I mean, and not to take you up, but, you know, I've talked to people all the time, people who've lost their jobs, whatever. You know, I used to work security over at Rensen for GM,
mm-hmm.
and they're a certified police department. They have full arrest authority when they're on duty. They can write tickets, everything. And if I'd have stayed there as a medic, I'd be a certified police officer. I'd be making $18, $19 an hour. We had free benefits, got paid every week. The union's already in there, been there for years. And I tell people, hey, if you go there, once, you know, you meet the, you know, requirements of the contract, you'll be making $18 an hour, probably $20 an hour by the time the new contract rolls around. And every, that works beneath me. Well, then don't complain.
Well, I, as you said, I'm not sure that's all going to be there. But, all right, David, thank you very much. Let's see. I thought I had, oh, yeah. Greg, who is listening on Saipan, the island in the Pacific, says, my mistake, since almost everything we get out here is tape delayed and replayed, I presume that that's what he's listening to. Awesome show, and thank you. And he has, geez, what are those little marks? Oh, those are all fishes. Man, you can make those out of, oh, interesting. Anyways, he says, what's down with Jesus, above the law, in over its head, and out of its mind? Why? It's the Bush administration. Well, I'm going to save those little figures, Greg, and I don't know what I'll do with them. All right. Oh, yeah, we got lots of time to get more calls. One open line for you, 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby here with you. Here's Paul in Ann Arbor. Paul, hi. You're on the air.
Hey. Hello?
Hey, Paul. Go ahead.
Yes, my question was...
Can you turn your radio 100% off, please?
Yeah, please. Hold on, give me a second.
Yeah.
Yeah, my question was this. I had, actually had a two-part question. What is the advantages, disadvantages in communism society versus capitalist society when it comes to our society at large? And the second one was, what was his honest opinion on the two?
What's my honest opinion of each system?
Yes.
Well, capitalism is a horrid system that has wreaked havoc on the world. Communism, as we've seen it take place in the real world, comes in as a bureaucratic police state. And so maybe what we need is those socialized forms of ownership where people are that the economy and people's lives are expressed as community, but we don't allow the police to run our lives in the manner that it was true of the Soviet Union and continues in places like China. But I mean, we're seeing the end of capitalism in terms of it playing itself out. Or I mean, I'm not trying to say it's going to end soon or anything like that. But industrial capitalism has hurt the web of ecology of the world in an irreparable way. When we see here start all that we know about global warming and what's happening to the seas, and also socially, where we always have a class that's suffering so badly. Sometimes it was in this class, or I'm sorry, in this country. Other times. Now it's around the world where we see such intense poverty, yet there's so much wealth. So one is economically and socially extraordinarily unfair, capitalism, and communism, as it's been practiced in the world, was incredibly unfair because it was so tyrannical. So maybe a synthesis of the two, taking the best of both, huh? I don't know. All right, thanks. Actually, it's a long, long question, and I'm not real satisfied with my answer. But I will stick with it to a large degree. All right, here is Stella in Hamtramck. Stella, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, happy Easter, Pete.
Thank you.
Thought I'd make your show bisexual since I'm the first woman calling.
Oh, okay.
It might be a stupid question, I don't know. You know how the guys that own the auto industry also own politicians?
Yeah.
Well, even with exporting jobs and everything, the auto industry is still doing really bad.
Yeah.
Why don't they push for national health care so they could be more competitive? Because that's what a lot of their, you know, problem is, having to pay the, you know, medical portion of the salaries.
You know, that doesn't make a bit of sense. One of the reasons, for instance, they've been citing some plants in Ontario, and maybe in Quebec, in Ontario, is because they know that the health care is being paid by the Canadian government. That's what you're saying, right?
Right.
I don't know. Maybe it is so ingrained, maybe that they've had to deny American workers or the American public a national health a program like every other industrialized country in the world for so long that they just can't get their brains around it even when it would help them.
Well, even like William Clay Ford, you know, it seems like, doesn't he have any pride, I mean, in his company? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what to think what motivates these guys. I mean, I couldn't live with myself. I mean, the idea that someone would say, here, Pete, you're getting $400 million because you've ripped off the public so much at the gas pump. Well, I mean, I couldn't live with myself if I presided over ripping people off to begin with.
Well, how many cars can these filthy rich guys buy? I mean, somebody has to buy the cars.
There's actually some guy in Dubai that has like 40 Rolls Royces. He's got a car that's made of silver. Yeah,
but this doesn't help all the assembly workers. I mean,
no, I don't get the motivation I don't know how someone can justify ethically having that much in a world where so many people have so little. I mean, someone could say the same thing about me. How can I be middle class where 4 or 5 miles from me there's people going through garbage cans for pop bottles? I understand that. But one of the things that I do, and I've done all my life, is try to fight for a system of social justice and economic justice so these great divisions of wealth and poverty don't exist in our country or in the world. Because it's hard for me to justify such obscene wealth on the part of the Lee Raymonds from Exxon of the world and what the poorest among us have. All right, Stella, thank you so much for making our show bisexual.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, she meant, I thought she meant either she thought it, never mind. She means be nice to have some women call. All right, hey, women, there's actually an open line or two for you. 313-298-WRIF. Pete writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Do you think a general strike will bring down gas prices? Yeah, you know what? A general strike like they had in France, it would, whatever we wanted to do. Want to end the war in Iraq? General strike. You know, no one works. No one works at all. You want gas prices down? Like that. Anything else? All the other problems. And in fact, France was a model. So it's not like unknown. But so he said, well, how do we do it? Okay, I want a general strike. Me, Peter, or Pete. Pete number one, Pete number two that wrote in, he wants a general strike. How do we do it? Nobody's out there that's organized that's doing it. Usually it comes through the unions, or in the case of France, it began with these student groups. So how do we push it forward? Well, you got to start just pushing the idea. So, but keep in mind my name and Pete's name, because let me see if I can find this real quickly on my this is ridiculous. There's something called thepetecollective.co.uk. The Pete, P-E-T-E, collective.co.uk. And what's going to happen is there is going to be this, as they say, an unnecessary gathering of people named Peter. So there is this guy who I've been, I don't know if he's got a last name here. No, he doesn't. Oh, Pete Bellamy. He lives in England. Pete, you listening? Maybe not. So he's putting together a gathering of June 10th in London, and the theme is Give Pete a Chance. I love it. So they need 2,000 Petes, 2,000 people named Peter, to meet me in one place at the same time. What could be simpler? So if you're a Pete or Peter, you can go to thepetecollective.co.uk. I actually don't think I'm going to make it. Oh, they got little signs, those kind of triangular, what are they? You know, they're square, turned on edge. Pete on board. Okay, whatever. Not very interesting, I agree. Let's see. Here's Aaron in Novi. Aaron, hi, it's Pete. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Just wanted to shift gears a little bit and
sure.
Talk about what's going on overseas in Iraq and going on possibly in Iran at the moment.
It's all going to hell, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is. Shoot. We got billions of dollars just being wasted over there.
Hundreds of billions.
All right. Boy. And now, with this war going on, we're also possibly going to war with Iran now.
Uh-huh.
I was hearing over the weekend that they were going to bomb Iran and all this other stuff. It's like, shoot, what's going on? I mean,
well, I don't know. I wonder. I mean, there was, in fact, is this? Yeah, I think it's this week. We got the show with. Oh yeah. If I looked at my own website, wait a minute here. Let me see. I actually don't have it up. But Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe.com. And the man is John, I see, actually the memory works once in a while. John Burroughs, who's head of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. And one of the things we're going to be talking about in about a half an hour with him is this article by Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker that talks about all the plans that are currently being developed by the insane people that run the government, that they've got the military ready to do up to and including a nuclear strike against Iran. I mean, this would be so horrible that it defies the imagination. You figure, ah, what the hell, nuke Iran or something like that, some old song people, idiots, used to sing. But, hey, this fallout. You know, they're going to do these tactical nuclear weapons, and it's going to fall on everybody. It's going to fall on people we don't like the insurgents right next door. It's going to fall on the people that we say we like, the Shiites. It's going to fall on the Israelis. It's going to fall on Europe. It's going to come around the globe. It's going to fall on us. It's called fallout. Some people think that the open-air nuclear tests of the 1950s are what created enough mutation and weakened immune system that allowed AIDS to develop, for instance. So isn't that nice? So what if there was, and this is pure speculation, but what the hell? Let's get scared because these people that are running things are absolute maniacs. A conjuncture of avian flu and a weakened immune system because of nuclear fallout that these madmen created by this absolutely unnecessary attack against Iran. Pardon me. Time to take a break. We'll be right back. If you want, call 313-298-WRIF.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com. Or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. At 1 o'clock, we're going to be talking about Iran and nukes. And then at 1:30, this is all Eastern time, in case you're listening on the island of Saipan or in Finland or in South Korea or Mexico, where some of you are listening. But right here in Detroit City, it's 1 a.m. Let's see. Terry writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Maybe I can help Lee from Taylor understand how the poor pay most of the taxes. I'm middle class. Last year I made a little more than $57,000. My tax burden was 29%. Dick Cheney made $8 million. His burden was only 12%. Well, yep, there you go. Roy is listening in Placitas, New Mexico. Hi, Roy. What is being completely left out of the discussion is the cruelest tax of all, he says. Inflation. The budget deficit and the trade deficit means inflation will truly take off. Right, and then our money is worth less. But hey, don't we, then we owe less, isn't it? I don't know. Isn't inflation the debtor's friend? All right, let's not get into that. Actually, I want to hear this one first, Brandon. Brandon is answering the phone. Thank you, Brandon. Here is Carrie. Carrie's calling from Kent. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
I love your program, buddy. I've been listening forever.
Thank you.
And I just wish more people would listen, because I try to talk to people about listening to your program so they'll be informed.
Yeah.
I'm a veteran, and I was telling your partner that I have a shirt that says, "Not My President." It's got a picture of Bush on it. It's black and white.
Great.
I was wearing it to the VA yesterday. That's one of my ways of expressing my opinion when I have to open my mouth. And a lot of people were kind of really digging it, and they were saying, "Oh, I wish I could find a shirt like that." And I was hoping maybe I could find out where I could buy, a supply of them, pass them along.
Well, I'll tell you, if you go to my website, do you have a computer?
Yes, sir.
Okay. If you, and my last name is spelled W-E-R-B-E. So,
right.
So you go to peterwerby.com, and if you go down the left column, there's a little bumper sticker that says, "Bring our troops home."
Right.
And if you go to that, if you click on that, that will take you to this whole page of stuff like that, T-shirts and bumper stickers and lawn signs, and you can make your opinions known. I mean, I've got a lawn sign on my lawn. It says, "Bring our troops home." And that tells your neighbors, that tells the passers-by that here's somebody that's not buying the Bush BS. Of course, and very few people still do. But still, I think it's a good thing to, to display publicly.
Well, I appreciate that. I spent a year and a half over there, and I'm not too happy underneath Daddy's, helmet. And I think that this whole thing has just gotten way out of hand, like you said earlier. And I'd really appreciate it if more people understood what's going on and how they're running this crazy war.
Yeah, Kerry, you were in Iraq?
Yes, sir, I was.
Well, also, if you go to, over on the left there as well, it says GI Resistance, and there's a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War. And it's hundreds and hundreds of Iraq veterans of the war that have come together to oppose it. Check it out, man. Maybe you could make an impact.
Well, definitely. I appreciate it. And you have a good night, okay? Happy Easter to you.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. All right. Let's see. Here's Mike. Mike's in Port Huron. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call. It's
sure.
A pleasure. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I'm glad you're out there. We needed some balance in talk radio, and frankly, there isn't any. There's too many Limbaughs and Hannity's, and it's refreshing to hear your program.
Sure. Multimillionaires who defend the interests of the multimillionaires.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. I thought I lost you.
No.
There's a fallacy. I just wanted to shoot this at you, see what you thought. There's like a fallacy out there given to the working class by these 700 and how many billionaires there are that somehow they can join them. By, it's kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you can be here too sort of thing, when in reality, that's probably not going to happen. And
In real statistical terms, Mike, it's not going to happen. We not only do we have a world class system with the ultra wealthy and also, class divisions down to, ultra poverty, but it's also a caste system, the way that we always think of that in in India, where people stay in the caste that they were born. So people say, no, this is America. It can be anything you want. Statistically, people stay where they are. So, and we've talked about this 100 times. Some people that are very poor become very rich. Once in a while, someone who's very rich becomes very poor. That's unusual. There has been an expansion of billionaires as the economy has expanded. So you'd say, wow, so that, you know, that's not true. Well, if you're talking about millions of people working, and most people, if they say, would you like to be a millionaire? People would say, sure. And in the time, say, the last 10 years, maybe there's been, I don't know, another couple hundred new billionaires. Statistically, in terms of people wanting to enter that status, it's negligible. So it's not, in fact, the exception proves the rule that there is not class mobility at all. People can strive all they want, but the part of it is that there is a whole, every status has its category of work, and it needs to be filled. So there has to be people working at the jobs that are, well, there has to be people working for 50 cents an hour in Indonesia. There has to be people working for $5.15 in Detroit. There has to be illegal immigrants working for $3.50 an hour in Arizona. So it's all set up. It's a caste system. And there's also a sacrifice class always that has to do the absolute worst and most dangerous and unhealthy jobs that literally kills people.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. I think that caller earlier, the gentleman who took himself out of poverty and invested his way to wealth, he's the exception, not the rule.
Definitely. Well, yeah, that's what I say. The exception proves the rule. There are people. Yeah. I mean, I know people. I mean, see, one of the things is, here's another thing. You start off when you're 21 years old and say you're from a middle-class background and you're working fast foods and you're making $12,000 a year. Well, and you're going to college, and then you go out and say you went to law school, and you start off making $35,000 a year. Well, by the time you're 55, you're making $150,000. You say, "What do you mean? Look, I started off poor. Now, well, it's just as you, if you're particularly if you're in the middle class or the way it used to be, as you age, well, within that class setup, you." Your income increased, but
All right,
thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see, here is Mansoor in Canton. Mansoor, hi, you're on the air. It's Peter.
Hey, what's up?
How you doing?
You know, I'm fine. And I was listening to the radio, and I was listening to music, and then I turned your show on, and you were talking about Iraq and Iran and all this stuff. I was actually born there. In Iraq, Baghdad.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a foreigner. I didn't really want to give out my first name because probably some people will know me.
Okay.
But Mansoor is a very popular Arabic name, so nobody would know who I am. But the thing is, people don't understand the whole foundation of what happened. Like, Iran and Iraq have been at war for, like, years on end. And what Americans never realized that it wasn't about weapons of mass destruction. It was all about Saddam. He was the destructor of Iraq. All he wanted to do was he wanted to control the whole Middle East countries.
Nah.
He was doing a good job of it. He was killing people if they didn't obey by his rules. I mean, my dad served in the military there,
uh-huh.
And God bless him for having my uncle here in America, in Michigan, and bringing us here. It took a lot. Yeah. I mean, we worked there, and Saddam was taking a lot of the profits of what we made. He didn't give a shit about people. I'm sorry for cursing.
Now, is your family Christian or Muslim?
We're Christians, but we were the minority.
Right.
We're Chaldeans.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Do you know what Chaldean people are?
They're Christian Iraqis.
Yeah, and we kind of migrated the smaller sector in Iraq.
And Saddam always persecuted the Chaldeans. That's why one of the reasons so many are here.
Yeah, because we fled. When he got in the seat of dictatorship, my dad And my uncle already was here in America, in Michigan, and we sold all our goods. My dad, I mean, the thing is, we came to America poor.
Uh-huh.
And people think that you're a foreigner and you get a free ride. No, we work our butts off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can be in a store and we can work 12 to 20 hours a day. My dad worked till he was seven. Like, my dad is 70 years old. He retired, like, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Because he's so sick. But the thing is, people think that we just come to America and we get a free ride. We don't.
Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of...
People that are... I think Americans that are born here don't appreciate what they have. When you're a foreigner come to America, you feel like, oh, my God, I got a bathtub. I got a radio. I got a TV. I got a refrigerator. I got food. I can go to the supermarket and eat whatever I want. We don't appreciate what we have here. And it's a goddamn shame.
Well, I appreciate it. Appreciate your call as well. Thanks, Master. Thanks for calling. Thanks for your story. Appreciate it. Let's see. Where are we going next? Here is Dean. Dean's in Taylor. Dean, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I had a question for you, but I want to make a small correction first, if you'll allow me to, on the
sure.
Cheney tax cut deal you're talking about.
Sure.
I think you're being kind of deceptive to your listeners in saying that he's only paying 12.5% because you guys are tossing around the $8 million figure, but what you're leaving out is the $7 million that he donated to charity, which you can write off as it's a tax write-off. So he's not paying $1 million or $1 million on $9 million. He's paying, I believe it's like $500,000 against $1.9 total income.
Well, whatever. I was trying to look. I remember he did. Sure he donated $7
million? I think the exact figure was like $6.8 million or something like that.
I'm looking.
But, I mean, these are tax write-offs that every American can include in their taxes if they want.
Well, whatever he did, it's still the tax, the higher you are in the tax bracket, the less you pay of, the schedule.
I disagree with that. I mean, I think it's actually the inverse of what you're saying. At the lowest tax bracket, you're going to pay, like 10% of your earnings, and it's going to increment upwards from that point.
Well, we can't argue about facts. Go ahead.
Throw some facts at me here, because I'm pretty sure in my tax bracket, I pay 25% of my income. Anything over $30,000 is 25% of my income.
Yeah, but then, but the more you go up in it, the more that there's deductions, the more that the tax code is written for those people. I mean, in fact, who probably gets screwed the most is probably the lower middle class, because if you're making $10,000 or $12,000 a year, as I said, I think there's a setup where you even get money back beyond what you didn't even pay into.
Well, then you're going to be talking about, who can afford the best accountant and whatnot. But the bare facts are that your bare tax numbers are definitely going to increment upwards the more money you make. I mean, I can attest to that myself, as I've seen my salary rise from, $16,000 a year at Walmart, 5 years later to where I'm at now.
Mm-hmm.
So you're definitely going to pay more taxes the more money you make.
Well, you're going to pay more taxes, but if everybody was supposed to pay like a third, that there's more write-offs and deductions that you have as you go up the income scale. And the facts, you said throw facts at you, the facts are that the more, the in fact, it's the whole thing. I mean, in fact, they had to have some put in, so what was it, some minimum tax so that they could stop this deal where rich people paid no tax a few years ago.
Well, I'd like to see how rich people paid no taxes. I mean, that would definitely be a sweet tax situation. But how can you explain that? How they would pay no taxes?
Well, with enough write-offs and losses and deferred income and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, if they're legitimate write-offs and legitimate write-offs.
Well, they're legitimate under the tax code, but it's sure not very fair.
Well, I'm not going to argue with that. Our tax code needs a major revision, but I just wanted to point that out because I think that is deceptive to say that, Shaney's paying 12.5% when in reality he's paying more than 12.5% of his reported income.
Well, I think thank you for defending Dick Cheney, but I think all one would have to do is look a little bit beneath the surface, and there'll be some malevolent intent in his generosity.
Well, and I hate to defend Dick Cheney too, because I think he's the biggest crook in the bunch. But you know, I just like everybody to present clear facts.
I agree. I agree. I didn't, I'm still looking for that, that story. I didn't see that part in it, but go ahead. Go ahead.
All right. So my next question is, I mean, it just seems like you were talking earlier about communism versus capitalism, and maybe I'm interpreting what you're saying wrong, but it seems like you're almost anti all of the principles that America's built upon. I mean, a capitalistic economy, a lot of the belief systems that America's had, a lot of America's our actions in the past. I mean, I don't hear.
Capitalism has mainly screwed people in this country. Yeah, you're right. The Cheneys donated about $7 million to charity from the stock options and royalties earned on Mrs. Cheney's book, America, a Patriotic Primer. But, you know, it's not clear whether that has. I mean, he couldn't have made. That means then he only made like $1 million. I don't know. I mean, this story isn't very. I see. They did donate this. They did from stock option royalties earned on Cheney's book or on Mrs. Cheney's book. This is not the you know the gay novel that she wrote. This is America, Patriotic Primer. Yeah. But yeah. Anyway, so the only reason, the only way that we've kept over the years from being totally screwed by the capitalist is by organizing over the years to demand more democracy rather than elite control and to organize into unions so that we get paid decent wages because unions have always led the way in terms of decent wages and benefits and what have you. But now it's beginning to be reversed. So we're going into more, we're going back to complete elite control, secret government, government that just lies routinely to the people, a media that's not aggressive in ferreting that out, politicians that are bought off, and we're seeing wage standards for the middle class and the working class go you know, down the drain, a race to the bottom, as globalization means that our salaries are globalized, and we're blackmailed into taking repeated hits on our benefits and repeated attacks on our wage and living standards, or we're told we're making too much money and they're just going to send the jobs to Mexico, which may be making too much as it is there, and so they're going to send them to China. So that's why I'm against it. Thank you. Let's see. Here's Rick. Rick, where are you calling from?
Newport.
Yeah, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I love the show, Peter. I just had a quick question about the war in Iraq. You know, the reason we were told that we were going to war was about the nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction. And once we get there, we didn't find them, and now we're still there to liberate the Iraqi people. How did that come into play, and why hasn't anybody called President Bush on that?
Well,
the press conferences, you know.
Well, yeah, this press corps, I guess, wants to keep getting invited back. The one reporter that does, maybe a few others do a little, but is Helen Thomas, who's been
right,
there.
Right, the older lady.
Yeah, been there for 40-something years, and they just kind of, you know, kind of, you know, she's like a doddering old lady or something. I mean, she doesn't get any respect. And I think most of them most of the reporters go by the principle, if you want to get along, you go along. If you want access to power, if you want to be seen on TV with President Bush in an exclusive interview, you don't give him a hard time. I mean, some of the people, I don't know if you've heard any of these, he's been traveling around, and he's went like in front of students at Johns Hopkins University. And it was embarrassing. The man is so stupid and so disconnected from the policy issues that are literally life and death to our soldiers and the Iraqi people. And he's fumbling and bumbling along. That I could have given better answers, and this was a pretty complex question, but he was clueless. Absolutely clueless, and I'm sure these students went away thinking, oh my God, this guy is the president of the United States.
Right, he's a bumbling idiot, basically.
Yeah, and how did this move along from stopping Saddam from developing weapons of mass production, which anyone who paid attention knew he didn't have, and Bush knew he didn't have, because we learn more and more that all of this evidence was presented to him in advance of Colin Powell's speech at the UN, in advance of all these lies that Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld told, that they knew all of this. They cherry-picked the most plausible stories, which in themselves turned out to be implausible, in fact, absolutely incorrect. And as I always give as the greatest evidence that Bush decided to attack before the UN inspectors could finish their job because he knew they would find absolutely nothing. And Bush lies. Every time Bush opens his mouth, he lies. And and what he said was that Saddam refused. Sometimes he says Saddam refused to let inspectors in, which is absolutely untrue. And sometimes he says that they kicked him out, which is untrue. They begged. What was the guy's name? I can't think of it. Like from Sweden or Denmark or someplace like that. All of a sudden, it's out of my brain. Anyways, the head of the inspectors, he said, Saddam is grudgingly cooperating. He would say, you can't come in here. It's our palace. And they'd say, hey, you got to do it or we're going to report you for being out of compliance. And then they'd let him in there. Saddam probably would have been toppled by a palace coup inside of the country because all of those power relationships are based on, you know, him being the supreme ruler, and his power was being quickly eroded because of the presence of foreign inspectors and what have you, and there were factions within the Iraqi government. Actually, none of this would have been necessary, but Bush wanted the war because he wants to occupy Iraq and the Middle East for bases so they can have this projection of military power and also control oil resources for the future, which is going to create, as it's created in Iraq, an enormous disaster in terms of misspent fortune and wasted human lives, and yet this goes on day after day after day. And I've got to get one or two more calls. Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Let's see. Hi, Tim from South Line. You got to do this real quickly.
Thanks, Peter. I like your show a lot.
Yeah, thanks.
I wanted to describe my situation real quick and ask for your opinion. I consider myself to be a progressive voter, progressive thinker, hopefully. I agree with most everything that you talk about on your show about, you know, the environment, about the war and the working class and all that's been talked about. But the one area where I diverge is on the abortion issue because I consider myself to be pro-life. And so what I would, the dilemma that I face is that when I go to the polling place, I either have to pretty much choose to throw out, you know, my beliefs in the abortion issue in order to pursue those more progressive issues that I believe in.
Well, here, let me cut you off because I've got about 30 seconds to answer myself. I know Christians that oppose abortion, oppose capital punishment, and oppose war. They call it the seamless garment. They say they want to first create an economic situation where people don't get women don't get abortions because they can't afford more children, which is a very frequent reason that women have them. Secondly, they want, with gentle persuasion, to convince women not to not to have abortions, to create a situation where if they bear children to term, they can be taken care of in a good manner. But they do not want the political state to impose the will of other people on women who think differently. So it's choice. It's not saying the right wing is compulsory pregnancy. They demanding, by virtue of male legislators passing laws, to have mostly male cops enforce reproductive considerations from one sector of the population onto women. This way, you vote for people that give people the choice, and you hope people will make choices according to the ones that you hold. I don't know whether that answers it or not, but I have to say goodnight and thank you.
Got a buck? Get a song.
Can I get a holla, holla?
Log on to WRIF.com and check out the digital music store. Any riff song is available for just 99 cents online. Browse by artist, title, or riff playlist. Easy and cheap. The Riff Digital Music Store at WRIF.com. Everything.
Get into it.
That rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you today. Nuclear weaponry, nuclear power is Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you today. Nuclear power is coming back into discussion in a way that we don't feel very comfortable about. The country of Iran has developed the ability to develop nuclear power. Many are afraid that it will be for nuclear weapons. Joining me, someone who is very concerned about this issue, is John Burroughs. He's the executive director of the New York-based Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, and he's just written a piece called Hirsch's Bombshell. Now, we'll talk with him about what that means and the issues as well. From New York, it's a pleasure to welcome back John Burroughs to the Peter Werby Show. Hi, John.
Yes, I'm very glad to be with you today.
Now, there's two elements to this. The one that appears to be the most of most concern to the world powers, including ones like Russia and China, is the fact of the Iranian announcement that they produced its first batch of enriched uranium that they say is going to be used exclusively for providing fuel for reactors. On the other hand, it appears the entire that other people are concerned, such as yourself, that this may presage an attack by the United States on Iran. Can you separate them? Is one worse a worse fear than the other?
I am certainly appalled by the fact that, as Seymour Hersh wrote in The New Yorker, and as I commented in the blog that you mentioned, disarmedactivist.org, that a very active planning for bombing of Iran is now going on in the Bush administration. And we can talk about the even more appalling fact that there's consideration, apparently serious consideration, of use of nuclear weapons against Iran. So to me, that is by far the most disturbing thing that is going on now. As far as Iran is concerned, they've been working at enriching uranium to produce fuel, which can be used for reactors, or if it's enriched to a greater extent, it could be used for weapons. They've been working at having uranium enrichment capability now for 15 years or more. And this demonstration yesterday that they could string 164 cascade centrifuges together in a cascade seemed to be more of sort of a demonstration than anything truly significant in and of itself. In the past, they have done at least some limited amount of uranium enrichment. The world is concerned about Iran's nuclear program, and when I say the world, I'm partly talking about the fact that my organization is based here in New York, and we talk a lot with diplomats from other countries, including countries that are on the Security Council. So there's a lot of concern about the Iran program, but there is, I would say, almost a unanimous feeling that military action or threats of military action are not appropriate or right with respect to the Iran situation.
Sure, Britain's foreign secretary said it'd be nuts using that word to launch an attack. And there's been a lot of reporting that there's been planning for an attack on Iran. And Bush over the weekend called it wild speculation. Rumsfeld called it fantasy land. So they're denying anything other than the normal sort of preparation for anything, as the United States does, is going on. How active does Seymour Hersh in his New Yorker article say this planning is, and how far along is it?
It has apparently gone beyond the stage of officers working away in the Pentagon preparing contingency plans for various situations. It seems to have gone up to a higher level. He reported that the Pentagon passed on contingency planning documents to the White House this winter. So it seems to be at a fairly high level. On the other hand, the New York Times and the Washington Post and follow-up articles, at least the New York Times was reporting, it's not at the same sort of frenzied stage that it was prior to the Iraq invasion. Here's how I see things playing out over the next few months, if you would like to hear.
Sure, absolutely, John Burroughs. Go ahead.
Yeah. It seems very unlikely that the Security Council is going to agree to impose sanctions upon Iran. There's already been a statement issued by the president of the Security Council here at the United Nations calling on Iran, to, among other things, to stop enriching uranium. But it seems quite unlikely that Russia and China are going to allow the Security Council to go much further than that. So we could get, I don't know, 3 to 6 months out from here where the Security Council will be stalemated, not able to do anything further, where the IAEA will not be making progress in resolving the situation in Iran. At that point, I think the United States and some of the European countries, Britain, France, Germany, will be enlisting other countries to join in the sanctions regime that the U.S. has been applying now to Iran for over a quarter century, you know, going back essentially to the hostage crisis. Then the Bush administration has also put $75 million into supporting opposition groups and supporting media campaigns with respect to Iran. They probably are already doing or will be doing covert actions aimed at sabotaging Iran's nuclear program. So that's one course that could be taken.
Well, let me just jump in here 1 second and let you expand on this a little. If this was just the United States that had discovered this problem, we might say, well, here we go again. This is another Iraq. We're coming up to the 2006 elections. Bush's poll numbers and the Republican parties are just down the drain. They've manufactured another incident. But even Russia and China, Russia, who is building a nuclear facility in southern Iran, they've condemned them as well.
Right. The IAEA board called upon Iran to stop enriching uranium and to stop or consider stopping production of a heavy water reactor and to allow complete access to IAEA inspectors, to various documents and individuals to clear up outstanding issues about Iran's nuclear program, its past violations of the Safeguards Agreement and its present intentions. So as you're indicating, European countries, even Russia and China, have backed the calls of the IAEA and of the Security Council upon Iran to cooperate to the utmost with the IAEA in clearing everything up and to stop its enrichment of uranium in the meantime. Because, of course, enriched uranium can be used either for bombs or, as Iran says, for civilian nuclear power. So there is agreement to a certain extent about the need for the international community to unite and to persuade Iran to completely cooperate. Where this international agreement ends, though, will be with respect to sanctions and certainly with respect to military action. Probably European countries following Britain, France, and Germany will go along with sanctions. Probably some U.S. allies will go along with them, but it doesn't appear that Russia and China will do so. But that is one possible path, as the United States would get a large group of countries to go along with sanctions and also this program of sort of nonviolent regime change, if you will, supporting opponents of the regime, and perhaps covert action. But a second path could be military action, and that's what's so disturbing about the in-depth reports, both by Hirsch but also by the Washington Post, about all the planning that's going on regarding air attacks.
Now, let me again just jump in here and ask you to amplify on that. Now, if we have a situation that's universally recognized as holding a potential for making the security of the world less, why wouldn't military action be appropriate? I mean, if we're, because without sanctions, without threat, the Iranian government says, "Hey, we're going ahead with this. We're at like a, what was it, like 164 centrifuges, and they're going to soon be up to 50,000, or what's needed in order to produce large amounts of fuel from which atomic weapons could be produced." So essentially, the question is, if there's no threat, they're not going to do anything different than they've already told the world. So why wouldn't concerted unified world military action, perhaps led by the United States, be appropriate?
Well, right now, Iran is 3 to 5 years away from being able to produce material, enriched uranium, for even a few bombs. The Bush administration seems to be convinced that Iran is on the path to acquiring nuclear weapons. But even if that's true, it's still a number of years away. But the rest of the world isn't necessarily convinced that Iran has made that decision to go that route. My opinion is, you know, and I'm not a technical expert, but I've been following this pretty closely, is that Iran has this nuclear power program for a number of reasons, one of them being national pride, but a second one probably being that they'd like to be in a position to make nuclear weapons in the future should they decide to do so. So all this comes down to the fact that there is no imminent prospect of Iran having a nuclear arsenal. But let me, you know, Peter, I'm with the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. We advocate for the application of international law to international security issues. Under international law, it's quite clear that you cannot just go and attack another country. There are basically two circumstances in which that is permissible. One is if the Security Council authorizes it, and the Security Council is not going to authorize it in the case of Iran for the reasons I just stated, and also because Russia and China are trying to maintain good relationships with Iran over the long term. The other circumstance in which you can wage war is in self-defense against an attack by another country. Well, Iran is not going to attack, it's not about to attack any other country. So there's no grounds for use of force, and that's why most of the world, you know, Britain might be an exception, but most of the world is not even going to consider military action.
Well, John Burroughs, didn't Iraq kind of make that? What did Attorney General Gonzalez say about the torture statutes, that they were something like antiquated or quaint or something like that? With the invasion of Iraq, that idea of international law has certainly been swept aside by the Bush administration.
Well, you got it exactly right. In 2002, the Bush administration announced its doctrine of preemption, which really is a doctrine of preventive war. It means, and the words of the strategy documents of 2002, that the United States reserves the right to take military action against countries which pose an emerging or a potential threat because of suspected acquisition of weapons of mass destruction and connections to terrorists. That doctrine was used as a pretext for the invasion of Iraq. Well, it was just restated in March. The National Security Strategy again restates this doctrine of preventive war and identifies Iran as a major threat to the peace. So you're right. The Bush administration basically has said we are trying to reformulate the principles of the UN Charter that apply to use of force. The rest of the world hasn't accepted this reinterpretation, and indeed, the Bush administration itself has essentially said, well, we can do this. Really, other countries shouldn't do this.
Well, the United States is the big kid on the block.
Yeah.
It can do that. In fact, it's virtually the only country in the world that that does do that. Or I guess you can go back to the Gulf War. The last time there was an unlawful invasion of another country was when Iraq invaded Kuwait.
Yeah, that's right. But I think you've also pointed to a larger problem. It's not only in the area of war and peace, going to war, that the Bush administration has pushed aside international law. The Geneva Conventions, and also a convention against torture clearly prohibit torture and other cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment of prisoners. And led by a lawyer, unfortunately, from my the law school I graduated from, University of California, Berkeley, John Yoo, lawyers in the Bush administration essentially just distorted this, what were well accepted within the Pentagon, within the U.S. military, requirements for how you treat prisoners, just distorted them in the name of national security and essentially said that torture is okay for the United States when carried out for national security purposes. And so this is the kind of attitude towards international law and international institutions that the Bush administration has been displaying.
Well, John Burroughs, how would you react to the idea? Essentially, this the Bush administration has enunciated as how it can operate in many ways comes from Henry Kissinger a generation ago. We have the power. We're not going to wait until for the niceties of international law. We're going to do what we have to do, and I'm always uncomfortable using that as a sort of generalized pronoun, the we. But the United States government is going to do what it needs to do as it sees best for foreign policy interests, and whereas lawyers and politicians can debate these fine points, ultimately we're going to do what we're going to do.
Right. Well, I have two basic responses to that. One is that you should do the right thing. You should do the right thing in your neighborhood and in your family, and you should do the right thing on an international level, too. And I think that's how most Americans think that their government should behave.
But then you got these awful guys out there. That's the argument. That aren't paying attention to the rules. We play by the rules. They don't. That's the argument.
Yes, that is the argument. you're right. That is the argument. But the second thing I would say, in addition to doing the right thing, is that if you want to have a world that is a livable world in which other governments are cooperating with the United States on problems like suppression of terrorism, and problems like global climate change, problems like containing the spread of nuclear and other weapons of mass destruction and eventually eliminating them globally. If you want to have the cooperation that we need to have a sustainable, livable world, then the United States needs to elicit that cooperation by itself playing by the rules.
I would also say, although no one asked me, I'll still give my 2 cents here. John Burroughs is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. This is my opinion. Is it ultimately rule-breaking doesn't work even by us, the good guys? Because if we look, and we haven't even gone back this far in history, if we go back to the origins of the current Iranian government and their reaction towards the United States and the rest of the world, you have to see the illegal acts of the United States going back almost 50 years when we began intervening in Iran, overthrowing governments, putting in police states into power. And then when they get overthrown in 1979, we've got these people that hate our guts. Well, hello. And the same thing. Abu Ghraib, how many that was okayed from the highest level? Maybe it did get a little teeny bit of information, but mostly it gave us such a horrible black eye and increased the hatred of the United States throughout the world. So I would say also that it just doesn't produce the results. It comes back ultimately to bite you in the butt, to put it a little crudely.
Yeah, well, I agree with that, and that's something that we need to understand about the U.S.-Iran relationship. The two countries are locked into what has been really quite an acrimonious and hostile relationship going back to the 1953 coup engineered by the United States and Britain against the democratically elected prime minister, and then coming forward to 1979, the hostage crisis, which produced a tremendous emotional trauma in the United States, and ever since the hostage crisis, basically, the United States has been treating Iran as a hostile state. And of course, the fact that you now have a populist Islamist leader in Iran, Ahmadinejad, who was elected last summer, doesn't help matters at all, because he is saying unacceptable things like denying the reality of the Holocaust, calling for wiping Israel off the map. And so once we have this kind of populism that's fueled by a sort of anti-colonialist spirit, it becomes, you know, very difficult to have good relations. And yet that's what we need. And one of the things that other governments have been calling for, including Britain, as became clear in a diplomat's letter that was released online by the Times of London, other countries have been saying, you know, the United States itself needs to talk to Iran. It isn't enough just to have Britain, France, and Germany talking to Iran, or just to have Russia talking to Iran. The United States needs to come into the picture, and there's a whole series of issues that need to be addressed.
Aren't they supposed to talk soon? There is over the Iraq situation. That's very strange. In fact, Iraq was objecting to Iran in the United States.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, there is talks, I believe it's between the U.S. ambassador to Iraq and Iran, concerning Iran's policy vis-a-vis Iraq. So it's supposedly limited to that. Possibly that'll serve as an opportunity for talking about other issues. But some of the things that need to be talked about, Iranian support for Hamas in Palestine and Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iranian policy towards Israel, Iran's need for security in what is a rather unstable region, and of course the nuclear issues themselves. But I, you know, the more I've learned about the nuclear problem in Iran, the more I've become convinced that it is solvable, that it would be possible to have an arrangement with Iran where the issues about their past violations and their past concealments are cleared up, and where they are allowed to go forward with a limited enrichment program under heightened international scrutiny led by the International Atomic Energy Agency. But when Russia floated this idea a few weeks ago, Russia said, well, there could be an enrichment facility in Russia, and then there could be limited R&D in Iran. Iran was interested in that proposal. The UN ambassador told me that just the other day. The United States immediately said, no way. So I think, and this is referred to in the Hirsch article, I think an underlying problem is that the U.S. essentially has a policy of regime change with respect to Iran. And when you have a policy of regime change, it's very hard to negotiate on discrete issues like the nuclear issues.
Yeah, and the Iranian government knows this. In Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker, by the way, you can go to the, I think it is just newyorker.com, or it's at my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. You can read this very frightening article that says the United States is preparing actively for a strike against Iran, perhaps even a nuclear strike. And when I said earlier, just a few minutes ago, about things coming back to the immediate violation of international law coming back to actually have its opposite effect, I suspect that all hell would break loose if the United States invaded Iran or bombed it only. I don't think they would invade it. The troops certainly aren't there. We can't even beat irregulars in Iraq. I think it would be a horrible situation if that was to occur. Do you agree with that, John Burroughs?
Yes, I do. And that, you know, this is pointed out in the Hirsch article, and many commentators have pointed it out, is that, first of all, Iran has the ability to support insurgents in Iraq. So it could make Iraq even more of a mess than it is. Iran also has the ability to take military action within the region. For example, they could strike oil production facilities in other countries.
And they could stop producing oil or sending it to the West.
That's right.
They
could try to stop shipment of oil in the Persian Gulf. If somehow Israel got drawn into this, have even a more incendiary situation. It's also possible if the United States attacks Iran that there would be terrorist attacks, whether supported by Iran or not, that could reach into the United States.
I think negotiations is the key. Unfortunately, there's a lot more here, and a good place to start is with John Burroughs' organization. He's the executive director of the New York-based Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. It's lcnp.org, and John's blog is disarmamentactivist.org, and that'll all be on my website, peterwerby.com, as well. John, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Yes, very glad to be here.
This is WRIF.com.
I've been up, I've been down. Take my word around. Ain't asking for much.
Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. Most of us, to most of us, the motorcycle is this icon of freedom, of rebellion. There's been so much American and North American mythology about the machine, and the people that ride it ride them, including us. I had a motorcycle when I was in my early 20s. I bet a lot of you did as well. Or if you're women, you're on the back of one. Or today, a lot of women have their own motorcycles, don't they? And probably an icon of outlaw motorcyclery are the Hell's Angels that are praised and condemned. A lot of stars like to be seen with them. You go way back to Altamont in 1969 and you know, that concert where someone was killed by the Hell's Angels. And Hunter Thompson, think about all the role in rock and roll and counterculture mythology the Hell's Angels play. There's a dark side to them, though, and to outlaw motorcyclists in general. And we, of course, realize that being about 75 miles away from London, Ontario, where 8 members of the Bandidos Motorcycle Club were killed just a few weeks ago, and now 5 people have been charged with their murders. Joining me from Montreal is Julian Scheer. He is the author of 4 investigative books on such topics as the Ku Klux Klan, the justice system, and organized crime. And he spent lots of years as a documentary producer with the Canadian Broadcasting Company. And along with William Marston, has written the book Angels of Death, Inside the Biker Gang's Crime Empire. And from Montreal, it's a pleasure to welcome Julian Scheer. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Great to talk to you, Peter.
You know, you almost would have said if this horrible event hadn't happened out near London, Ontario, maybe they're being a little, they're exaggerating things a little. But this, this big book that published by Carolyn Graff, on one hand, for the authors, it couldn't come out at a what kind of time? Because they, I don't want to say opportune, because no one likes to revel in murder, but an appropriate time.
That's true, but you know, the sad tale about the biker gangs is that if you publish a book almost at any time, it would be opportune because there are just so many similar stories. Look, just last week in Connecticut, there was a biker who was assassinated in some kind of drive-by shooting. We talk in the book of other murders that took place in Arizona, and trials are coming up in a few months on those cases. I think what we tried to show is exactly what you referred to at the beginning, is peel back this sort of PR image that the Hell's Angels have been able to spread, and look a bit behind this iconic myth that we have of the freedom fighter and the easy rider, and say, well, you know, that may have been the case in the 50s and the 60s, but it's a much darker story today.
Well, In their defense, the Hell's Angels say, hey, look, if we're this crime organization, if we're guilty of all these transgressions, we're the only criminal organization that advertises on the backs of our jackets. So they say they're victims of police attention, of their victims of their representation. Julian Scheer, how bad are they, and what do you describe in Angels of Death?
Well, you know, I always say I agree. I don't think you bring your own personal prejudices or anything to the table. You judge people on their actions. First and most important, the Hell's Angels themselves define themselves as outlaws, right? They proudly, as do the Banditos and the Vagos and the Mongols and all the various outlaw motorcycle gangs that exist in the Detroit area, very strong in the Midwest of the United States, say that they are part of what are called the One Percenters, because it comes from a very famous incident when the Hell's Angels were born in 1947 in California, when they trashed the town of Hollister. And, you know, the standard middle of the road, if you want, motorcyclists said, oh, well, 99% of motorcycle enthusiasts are law-abiding. And so from that day on, the outlaw motorcycle people called themselves outlaws, and they said, we're the One Percenter. So they themselves define themselves as outside the law, they try to do it in a romantic way, you know, the Billy the Kid image, you know, the Jesse mm-hmm. James image, right? But they're outlaws. They say we have our own code, our own laws. And unfortunately, those codes and laws can mean not only things like drug dealing and trafficking in products like meth, but in murder. And it's documented. You know, the there are cases before the courts and convictions of very many Hell's Angels leaders.
You know, Julian Scherer, just out of nowhere, it reminded me what you just said of this film in the 1970s that starred Donald Sutherland and Jane Fonda. And she says to Donald Sutherland, he says, "You're just a crook." He said, "I am not. I'm an outlaw." And yeah. She said, "What's the difference?" And he says, "I don't know." But there is culturally an outlaw. People identified with that spirit of rebellion, as I
rebellion.
Said.
Rebellion, and that's been the Hells Angels' beauty. Just as you said, look, the mafia. You know, John Gotti doesn't. You know, and his people don't traipse around New York with a tattoo stuck on their forehead saying, "I'm a proud member of the mafia." The Hells Angels do that, and it is this outlaw image. You know, the bike has replaced the horse and the Wild West. The problem is that it's an image, just like, you know, McDonald's golden arches or the Nike swoosh, and you know, people have to look what's behind the image. What are they actually doing? Look, you know, we tell the story in our book of two Hells Angels in California, birthplace of the Hells Angels, where there's a member who leaves the club, and he leaves in what is called bad standing, you know, leaves in not good graces. And Sonny Barger, at the time the leader of the Oakland chapter and the most famous biker, calls a meeting with other members of the group because they're looking for some of the people who they think, you know, are not trustworthy. Well, eventually these two bikers track down this man named Billy Grindowski, and they go to his house, and they literally want to take the tattoo off of his skin.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, but it gets even worse. Gun goes off accidentally. Billy gets killed. And then the two Hells Angels are standing there, and they've just killed a man accidentally. Well, their problem is the wife is standing right next to him. So what do? They kill her. Then they kill a teenage boy, their son, and then they stab multiple times a 5-year-old girl, Dallas, who witnesses this. And at one point, the other biker gets so frustrated with how long it takes to slash her to death, he says, "This is taking too long," and puts a bullet through her. Now, we tell the story of how it took one police officer 18 years to eventually track down and convict those two men. So, you know, my point is this the kind of outlaw image that you want to be associated with? Has the Hells Angels ever held a news conference denouncing those members?
Could it be argued that, hey, you got some bad apples among bad apples, even, and you can't hold, and are you saying his name Barger? I've always heard it as Barger.
I've often heard it as Barger, but apparently the correct pronunciation.
Okay, we'll call it.
Let's call him Sonny.
Let's call him Sonny. So, I mean, can Sonny and the 99% of the rest of the 1%, if you will, don't kill people, and so is it fair to condemn the whole organization?
Okay, good point. So the argument I gave is look at the Abu Ghraib military controversy. You know, the torturing of prisoners, right?
Right.
Because some soldiers and maybe even senior people condone or do torture in Iraq. Does that mean you condemn the whole military? No. But how does the military react? Or look at the sexual priest scandal, right? In the Catholic Church. The question is, what does an organization do when some bad things happen by some of their people, right? If it's a good organization, it stands up and says, "This has nothing to do with this. We condemn this. We are kicking these people out," right? And the challenge I've thrown out to members of the Hells Angels is, when has any leader held a news conference and said, "Boy, those people just got charged with cocaine trafficking, or they've been found guilty. That's horrific. We're shocked. We're against cocaine trafficking. They have been kicked out of the club for cocaine trafficking." You know, doesn't happen.
My guess is Julian Scherer. He is the co-author of Angels of Death, Inside the Biker Gang's Crime Empire. Tell us about the structure. I was actually struck with how formal the organization of the Hells Angels is.
Well, that goes back to the point we were just talking about. You know, if you have bad apples, that's one thing. But if you are in charge of selecting the apples, if this is the hardest bushel in the world to join, right, then you have some responsibility for the people who've been let in. It is a very elite group. It is harder to get into the Hells Angels than it is into the U.S. military or to the police. They screen people. They do not only credit checks and private security checks. They want to make sure that you're not a cop or an informant. They want to know who you are. So you have to spend a long time hanging around with them. That's literally what it's called, the hangaround. Then you become a prospect. Finally, you're allowed to join, and you get that patch on your back. And there's a whole series of strict rules and protocols to follow. So if it's so hard to get into this group, when so many, and the rough police statistics are roughly about 80% of members of outlaw biker gangs have criminal records, then the whole organization does, I think, have to take into account the people they've included. You know, I'm always struck, and again, you know, it goes back to people should be courageous. They should stand up for what they believe in. You're wearing that patch on the back. You want to be proud of it? Great. But that means you have to be proud of everything that people who wear that patch do. You can't disassociate yourself and say, oh, well, that wasn't us. The fact that they're wearing a patch and they killed that family had nothing to do with us. Doesn't work that way.
Tell us a little more, because you do in Angels of Death, about the process of joining and how long it takes and what some of the tasks that the prospective members of the Hells Angels are required to do, and how one of the things it's hard to infiltrate. In other words, somebody can't say, yeah, go join the Hells Angels for 8 days and get the dirt on them.
That's right. It usually takes anywhere from 1 to 2 years to go through that process of being a hang-around and then a prospect. You're basically a gopher. You're sent to do a lot of the dirty work. There's a myth, you know, created by the media that, you know, you have to murder somebody or do some horrific crime to join the Hells Angels. No, that's not true. But they are going to check you out, and they're going to want to know where you came from and what you've done. They often will use these gophers to do some of both the slave labor but also some of the enforcement tactics, some of the extortion. The beauty, though, of the Hells Angels is that, you know, I always say Al-Qaeda could learn lessons from these guys when it comes to this cellular structure. Because unlike the Mafia, where if you take down the Godfather, you can cause serious damage, the Hells Angels is both hierarchical, but each chapter is fairly autonomous. So recently in the Midwest, several leaders of the Chicago Hells Angels were arrested and convicted on serious conspiracy charges, but that doesn't affect the workings of the gang in Detroit or New York. It doesn't affect the people in California. Several members right now are standing trial in Las Vegas for a huge casino shootout where two groups of bikers went at it with guns and knives. You know, their arrest doesn't affect the other guy, so it's quite a brilliant structure, because each chapter is independent, and each member within the group can be independent and have his own coke or meth ring going without the other guys knowing about it.
Now, you talk about the number of chapters both here, and actually it's really interesting that they have them in places like Finland and what have you, but over, what, internationally they have 2,500 members, I think.
2,500 members in 25 countries, about 1,000 in the United States, and it's that international network that really gives them an edge. For example, there was a huge meth network that was broken up that included importation of drugs from South Africa and the Hells Angels in South Africa into the Southwest United States. Another big shipment of cocaine moved from Venezuela and Latin America to England and then to make its way back to North America. And the Hells Angels played a key role in each of those stops. So that international network is quite good. And it serves another purpose. There are a couple of Hells Angels in Canada who are on the run on murder charges and conspiracy and drug charges. And they're hiding somewhere in countries like Brazil that don't have extradition treaties. So it's an escape route as well.
Now, Julian Scheer, you, of course, as we've been saying, are the co-author of Angels of Death. You also have in today's Toronto Globe and Mail an article about the bandidos, the ones that were killed up around Toronto. Now, this is a surprise to us, because we always think of Canada as being extremely nice kind of thing. When an American bumps into a Canadian, the Canadian says, I'm sorry, excuse me. It just seems, you know, how stereotypes are, but it just seems way out of the Canadian stereotypes that there are Hells Angels and bandidos in Canada.
What's even more out of the stereotype is that the bikers in Canada, in part because of the monopoly they had, were in fact more vicious than the bikers south of the border in the United States. Canada has about 500 Hells Angels, which is already huge compared to the, say, the 1,000 that there are in the United States. The difference is that the Hells Angels in Canada have a virtual monopoly. You know, the colors of the Hells Angels are red and white, and we like to say that, you know, this is it's red and white from coast to coast. Coast, and it's not just the color of the Canadian flag. Well, what happened in Canada, and some people may have heard about it, it's not just the 8 murders recently that the Bandidos did against their own members, but in Quebec, the French province in the east of Canada, there was a biker war between the Bandidos and the Hells Angels. Bandidos based in Texas, Hells Angels coming out of California, that put 160 bodies, 160 bodies, in the streets of Montreal in the space of a few years. Now, when you think about it, Al Capone in the Chicago Wars, there was like no more than about 30 bodies in all of that famous gangland slayings. So it shows how far the viciousness was. And then in Europe, the Bandidos and the Hells Angels went at it, literally a war with anti-tank rocket launchers, plastic explosives, grenades, more than a dozen people killed as they fought for territory in Scandinavia. And the American leaders eventually sort of had to sit down and work out an uneasy truce. So what's interesting, if you think about it, is that the Hells Angels and biker gangs are really the only crime export that America has given to the world, right? Because think about it, right? Mafia, you could say, well, you know, came from Italy to Detroit to New York and the shores of the U.S., right? Mm-hmm. Asian gangs and the triads. But what did America give to the world from the point of view of crime? The biker gangs.
Julian Scheer, you and your co-author, William Marston, actually, he wrote, I just see here, that sounds like an interesting book as well, The Road to Hell, How the Biker Gangs Are Conquering Canada, a couple of years ago. How do these guys regard you, too?
Well, a colleague of mine, one of the most famous crime reporters here in Montreal, was shot 6 times in the back by the Hells Angels, who didn't take kindly to his writing. Miraculously, he survived, in part because the bullets apparently were deflected by the umbrella that the assassin was carrying to hide the gun. That attempted shooting of one of the most popular journalists sparked such an outrage, it eventually led to one of the big crackdowns against the bikers and tough new anti-gang laws. But look, you know, I've met people across the country in the United States who have stood up to the bikers. Remember the story I was telling you about this family in California? Well, there was the sister, the surviving sister of that family, who saw her family being slaughtered by the Hells Angels, stands up to the bikers, tries to fight against them. When they send flowers, she throws it out the window. And she works with the prosecutor, a brave prosecutor and this deputy sheriff, to put the Hells Angels away for that murder. So there are brave, ordinary people, including journalists, who stand up to these guys. I've debated some of them on the radio, and
really?
I've spent time in some of their houses and met with some of the leaders in California. It goes back to what you were saying about bikes, you know. You know, man for man, an individual member of a biker gang can be quite nice, can be quite pleasant, can be a delightful father. It's not about culture. You know, it's not about who wants to ride a bike and ride a Harley. It's, are you committing crimes or not? Right? Are you breaking the laws of society? Are you raping women? You know, are you dealing in dangerous drugs like meth that are killing our kids on the streets? That's the issue. It's not about what lifestyle you have.
I guess partly I was asking, do you worry for your own safety? That was really, I guess, the blunt.
No, I do, but, you know, I think I get inspiration from these ordinary people who stand up. And, you know, I knock on the doors of clubhouses or go to meet Hells Angels leaders, you sort of take your chances.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think some of them actually respect both the work that I'm doing, and they respect the books because they're truthful, you know, and frankly, they don't, you know, mind being portrayed as outlaws. That's what they're proud to be.
Mm-hmm. Julian Scheer, as I said earlier, you have in today's Toronto Globe and Mail an interview with the Bandidos, and you spoke with them. I mean, so they know who you are, for instance.
That's right. I remember speaking. I phoned him up and I said, "Hey, here's some of the stuff I've written." He said, "Yeah, I've seen some of your stuff." I said, "You know, they know I know the biker scene. They know that. Look, I'm a journalist. I don't pick sides with the cops. I'm as critical of the police when they make a mistake or arrest the wrong people or use dubious tactics as I am of the bikers. Look, you know, the job of a journalist is to peel behind the kind of PR machine, whether it's the police or the government or the bikers. And I think that's what we try to show. I remember one biker checked me out with some of his biker friends, and he'd seen earlier books I'd written on the bikers, and they said, "Yeah, you know, he's a stubborn pain in the ass, but you could talk to him." Well,
it doesn't get the compliment.
I'll take that as a compliment.
I was going to say, for a journalist, the government is not a bad compliment at all. In your article, you say that the Bandidos were effectively wiped out as a serious force in both Quebec and Ontario by the police. What in the world went on with this kind of mass slaughter? I mean, that's way beyond the 1920s Chicago St. Valentine's Day massacre in terms of people that got gunned down.
It is, although, believe it or not unprecedented. In 1985, five members of the Hells Angels were slaughtered in a clubhouse in Quebec. Same kind of thing, this sort of internal cleansing. What I always say is, look, bikers kill people, and bikers kill their rivals. And sometimes those people and those rivals are in their own club. There are many unsolved murders. When I was down in Arizona, there was a close friend of Sonny Barger, who got assassinated. Police are convinced it's an inside job. So there are many murders that go unsolved. In the case of the Bandidos, we're not sure what happened. We're fairly certain, based on my investigation, this wasn't ordered by the Texas headquarters. But people are speculating it could have been a drug ripoff. There also could have been, believe it or not, the Bandidos, some of the Bandidos in Canada have switched over, if you want, betrayed the cause and gone over to the Hells Angels. I mean, that's like, you know, members of the Yankees taking off their uniform and going over to the Dodgers. You know, it doesn't happen in the biker world, and there are consequences to that. But it shows, you know, the level to which these people will go to preserve their turf and to preserve their power.
I suppose in Montreal, you guys get HBO. You see, like, The Sopranos. You ever?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. One of the things that strikes me about the show, when I say, God, who would like to live a life like this? That with always all this tension, all this, you know, I mean, like with my friends, I can trust them implicitly, and you get the idea you can't trust anybody. The cops are after you. Rival gangs are after you. And I don't even know if this is a fair question to ask, but do you ever get a sense of the motivation, why these guys would want to live a life like this? It seems like it's so counterintuitive to people that would like to, you know, to live like a nice, peaceful life.
Well, but it's precisely because they don't want to live a nice, peaceful life. There's a natural thrill, but not just the thrill of, you know, riding a bike. There's a natural thrill to living the life of an outlaw, right? To be going against, you know, I mean, if you think about it, you know, straight society, if you want, mainstream society, pretty boring obligations. So that sense of rebellion. There's a sense of brotherhood and camaraderie, which is very real. I mean, if you talk, I talk to a lot of ex-bikers and current bikers. It's very real. I mean, these people will die for you. They will lay down their lives for you. Very much a band of brothers, like a military, right? So there's that. And especially for people who have come from either a poor background or are not going to succeed, are not going to make, you know, big careers in journalism or become teachers or doctors. This is a way for huge social standing, success in the community, and also easy riches. I mean, I've talked to biker leaders who are prominent, who have been called the Al Capone of their towns, and they're proud of it. So it's not that hard, actually, to see the attraction. The problem is that the life expectancy is
low,
not very good.
Yeah. Let's just real quickly. Whoa, we only got about a minute and a half left with you, Julian. Sure. Inside the biker gang's crime empire. So it's a criminal empire. They've existed now for 50 years almost. They're more than 50 years. How do they keep going? What any sense what the police agencies can do or should do?
Well, what we try to document is some of the lessons police have learned, and what they've learned is precisely because this is a very secretive organization, the only way to bring them down is not on, you know, petty traffic stops or the occasional drug bust, but through deep, long-term infiltration. The only way. There's no other magic solution. This is costly. We're talking millions of dollars, and it's usually done in two ways, with informants, snitches, rats, stoolies, whatever you want to call them. There's one case we document of one biker who participates in the brutal slaying of a woman in Arizona and decides to turn his fellow bikers in. So they use people like that, however distasteful it is, or, unbelievably, real cops, female and male cops go in undercover and become bikers. Very dangerous, very up to the line in terms of legality, and we document a few of those cases. Very, very difficult, but it makes for a great read.
And so does Angels of Death. What a book! Angels of Death is the name of it, Inside the Biker Gang's Crime Empire, All You Wanted to Know, or Maybe Were Afraid to Know, About the Hells Angels. William Marston, and also our interviewee for this portion of the Peter Werby Show, Julian Scheer. Thanks so much for spending time with us. I can't wait to get all the way through this.
Great. Pleasure talking to you, Peter.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Thank you. I love your nuggets.
The Riff.
Pop it in and turn it on.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
Well, I just heard the news today. It seems my life is gonna change. I close my eyes, begin to pray, then tears.